be that as it may, our interaction today does not necessarily need us to correct, because for us to correct we need 7 members. So we are not taking any decision. In fact, the intention is just for the two entities to inform us what they are about. An opportunity that we have not given them since we took office last year. But this is an opportunity we have given to all other programs of the department, except the entities that report to the department. We have not afforded them this opportunity to speak to us of who they are, what do they do, what are these important strategic areas of work that they think we should know, and again, how are they faring in terms of sticking and implementing their mandate, and again, how does their mandate enhance the work of the Department of Environmental Affairs. So broadly, so you, that's it's a briefing, in short, of what the entities are about. There are 4 entities in this department, or that report to the department. There is Sandy, which is here today. There is SOARS, which is here today. There's Sunparks, that will be joining us Tuesday. And Isimangaliso, that will be joining us Tuesday. So we will have completed the picture of getting a broad overview of the department and its entities. What do they do? What do they stand for? What challenges are there, and how can it be of assistance as a portfolio committee? Honorable Mavilo, if that pillar doesn't disturb you, can come in front. This one. If it disturbs you, come closer to Honorable Mrs. Edwards. Oh, from that side. Oh, so if you are comfortable, no problem. From our side, having explained what this is about, from our side, I'm Jackson Temple. For those who might not know who the speaker is, I'm the chair of the Portfolio Committee on Environmental Affairs. I would like to introduce other members. I think they have the relevant capacity to introduce themselves, starting with Mr. Mabino.
Good morning, Chair, colleagues. My name is Patrick Mabino. I'm a member of this committee. I'm from the Northern Cape, representing the ruling party, the ANC.
Morning, everyone. I'm Silent Makuvela, a member of the ANC.
Hi, everyone. I'm Joyce. Edwards, sorry. I recently got married. Last time you told me I was CNG, now it's Edwards. Okay, let's just say I'll get you. I'm from the CA.
Thank you very much. That's who we are. Of course, we have the secretary of the committee here that many of you might know very well. She's together with Daryl, they organize these meetings on our behalf. She's Mrs. Maduela. Now, she also has this story about being married, but she still uses her maiden surname. I don't understand this. I never must speak to the husband. So that's the purpose of this meeting, and that's who we are. May we then allow yourselves to introduce yourselves so that we know who we are speaking to. Can we start with SOARS?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members. I am Linda Makuleni, the CEO of South African Weather Service. I'm also with our board member, who is also a member of the Audit Committee and also a member of the Programs Committee, where we look at programs that are aligned to the science and also to our mandate. Mr. Nick Nicholson is sitting there. I also have my other board member, Judy Bowman, who is also the GDG for Program 4. And I also have the team. I would like the team to introduce themselves. We also have a new kid on the block who has joined us, who's going to be responsible for commission. Thank you, Chair.
Good morning, members. My name is Nikele Ndabambi, General Manager Operations, South African Water Service. Thank you.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Yanda Majogweni. I'm the General Manager of Corporate Affairs.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Mafula Kari.
Well, where are you, Mafula? That's the new kid on the block. Okay.
I'm too short, Chair.
Honourable Chair, and greetings to our members of the Portfolio Committee. My name, though you can't see me behind the pillar, is Tanya Havlinsa, and I'm the CEO of Sandy, and I'm very honoured to be accompanied by my colleague, Mwenkete Kwakhe, who is our Chief Corporate Officer, and also glad to have our chair, Mrs. Nana Makomola, with us, and that's our delegation.
Thank you very much. I know we also have colleagues from the department led by a board member. Board member, can you introduce your delegation?
Good morning, Chair, and good morning, honorable members. I was not sure when you were talking about board member, whether it's myself or
are you also
because
a
I also sit on the Sandy board.
Oh,
the
now they forgot to mention you.
That's why I'm making a point of emphasizing that, Chair. My name is Kung Saman Mwaja. I'm the acting DDG responsible for biodiversity and conservation within the Department of Environmental Affairs.
Yes, sir.
Good morning, Chair and members. Rian Okomp, the Acting Chief Operating Officer of the Department of Environmental Affairs.
Department, are you done? Or you at times you forget that you are from the department?
I'm Judy, but I'm responsible for climate change and air quality management, Deputy Director General.
Good morning, honourable members. I'm Bonseni Sano, the director in the office of the DG.
Thank you.
Any other person from the department? Forgotten that they are from. Okay, those are from the Ministry 5, you know. okay, colleagues, on a serious note, you know, it's not very often that we have this opportunity. Where we interact without necessarily looking at your targets, without necessarily looking at what the Auditor General said about you, without necessarily looking at whether you have been able to achieve your quarterly goals and objectives and met your targets. So this has nothing to do with it. There will be times when we call you where we look into those issues, but today, just be yourself, just open up and say who you are. To board members, we always say when we meet with colleagues under this wonderful atmosphere, that just seems that you are just meeting with your wife or with your boyfriend and you are having a chat, then just having a nice discourse of what it is that you do and what are the challenges and what are the achievements, first of all. Don't start with challenges, what are the achievements? Again, we all know that we come from an environment where many people of this country were not treated as people of this country. We come from an era where many state institutions badly represented a particular section of the South African population. So some of us will also be interested in what transformative measures have we seen in the entities. By the way, where the apartheid stance was more dominant and where the apartheid picture was more dominant was in the state-owned entities, by the way. So you are state-owned and some of you don't even, you didn't only get born in 1994. You were born long before 1994. But can you truly say you are an entity that is representative of the people of our country today? Secondly, as you implement your mandate, is it all encompassing? Does it include all those that were in the territory, not only of the politics of the country, but also periphery of the economics, periphery of even environmental matters. In fact, they were nothing. People that, I always say this to members of the board, we have a constitutional injunction, all of us, particularly the Department of Environmental Affairs, that is properly put under Section 24B of this Constitution. It says we have this obligation to ensure that our people are protected or their well-being is protected from the harmfulness of the environment. And again, we also are duty-bound to protect this environment for future generations. I'm not quoting that section verbatim, but I can tell you I've quoted everything it says. And this is what we're about. And this is what we're about. We would then like to see how far are you assisting that department in this important constitutional obligation. Again, let me just say what we have been saying wherever we went, where we do oversight. Many of you will remember that we have many people in our country, and many of them happen to be black, who were subjected, who were victims of, is it asbestosis?
Yes.
Is that the right to, he told me something the other day, asbestosis. And even when an opportunity arose where class action was taken against the company that caused their ailments, many of them, even when monies poured in, they couldn't use those monies because they were no more. They were dead. Even those that were not dead were on their deathbed. We are raising these issues because this matter is very much in keeping with what we must not do wrong. We did so many things wrong. I'm just citing one example. There are many others that we could cite. That's why we go all over the place to see how are we treating and enforcing, monitoring our air quality standards. We go all over the country. And we were saying to the CEOs yesterday, what we found in many safety laws and standards. So it's something that we'll have to look at. But we'll have to see how do you come into the fray yourselves, that by the source, who one of your mandate is to provide air quality services. So how do we come into this area of work, among others? But that was just digressing a bit, but it just indicates how close our hearts are to this area of work. And to us, it's not just an area of work. It's an area of work that concerns our people. These are the people who brought us here, who made us parliamentarians. If we can't safeguard their health, their public health, their well-being, as instructed by the Constitution, we don't then need to be here. If we're a little bit hard on you, you must know that we're not doing so because we are by nature negative. No. We are doing so because we are serving the people that brought us here. If we are. I don't think that today we will be. We'll ask questions. We will be hard on you if you don't meet your targets that you yourself have said. By the way, we were not there when you set those targets. When we meet with you on your quarterly reports, in fact, we have not met with you on your, I'm telling your board now, you know, we told you some other time. When we meet with you on your quarterly performance 14-15, we will be hard on you. Rest assured. Now, please prepare yourself. When we meet with you on your first quarter performance 2015-2016, we will be hard on you, very, very hard. But we'll also ask other questions. These communities that you are supposed to be serving with these monitoring stations and your SACIs, how often have you gone to them to dipstick? We'll ask you all these questions. But for today, I think we'll have a wonderful thing. You don't have much time, CEO. You have an hour at most to take us through what you are doing, what you have done over years, and why should we be proud of you? What challenges are there? Life, by its nature, has challenges. What challenges are there? And again, where in one or two areas would you expect our intervention and our assistance? The platform is yours. I hope, Linda, you are the person that is giving us the presentation. The platform is now yours. Thank you very much.
You can
also time yourself. It's now 9:51. At 10:51. Is it 10:51? Your presentation should be done. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Usually the word of these presenters, they like to say something taba. So probably that's what I'll need to do to move as fast as lightning. I must say it's a daunting task, considering the fact that, and I think we should be proud as South Africans, because we don't talk about it a lot. South Africa was one of the first countries in the world to establish a weather service. What it means, we've got data that goes to 155 years when the institution was established. But we've got a young state-owned entity. It was first established as an entity in 2001. Chairperson, I think my presentation, I'll just look at the mandate itself and also look at some of the emerging issues that are an area that we are giving support to our department and also to the public at large. The issue of climate change, we have been talking about it a lot, and at the political level, at policy level, and even companies as well. They see the climate change issue as one of the primary risk areas. And the question has been, how do you then as a country provide the climate services that will assist in weather decision making or risk management or policy making? So I will also talk about the National Framework for Climate Services. which we are working very closely with the department in ensuring that as a country, it also have that structure in place and coordination as well. And usually when I talk to people about the weather service, people, they see weather service as an institution that is providing minimum and maximum temperatures and also part of the maybe department, SAP. But the organization goes beyond that. There is a lot of work that the institution is doing. In fact, it's providing services across different sectors and also different departments. One of the areas that is very important for the weather service for now and also the future is generation of knowledge. The weather service, we are a custodian of national climatological data, and as I've indicated, the data dates to 155 years. And we are also an accredited regional training center, not only training the med services within the country, working with different academic institutions, but also providing training within the continent as one of the regional training centers of the WMO, because weather knows no boundaries. So if we are strong as South Africa, and Namibia, Zimbabwe, and others are not as strong, it becomes a challenge for us, because there is some information that we share in order to make our predictions and also provide confidence to focus them. The other area, Chair, that I think is also important for us to look at it together, and you've indicated some of the challenges in terms of looking at issues of air quality. As we start to bring in the laws to govern and ensuring that our people are healthy, the environment is safe, you also need to have the scientists or the people with the competences and the skills that are required to do this work. And the Weather Service, one of the areas, as also a training center we've looked at, is to look at what are the requirements in terms of the capacity for us as the Weather Service, but also for example, the municipalities and others. So we have been working with a number of stakeholders to come up with a proposal in terms of the national educational plan for some of the skills that are required. And those will be the areas of discussion. Next slide. We are governed by the South African Weather Service Act, which was, and it has been also been the act that has been amended, and also the PFMA and other associated regulatory national treasuries regulatory. Members, I'll just unpack some of the key responsibilities of the Weather Service in terms of the mandate. One is the provision of reliable weather services supporting the public good and its commercial ventures to ensure safety of life and property. And you've indicated that, Chair. And the question in there is to say, how have we done from 2001 up to now? And what is it that we're going to be doing moving forward? I must say, the Weather Service, we are a member of the World Meteorological Organization. We have other med services, I think it's 190-something members in that. And then in Africa, we were one of the best med services in terms of the infrastructure, in terms of the human capital that we have. We have moved into from 2007 up to now. I'll give you an example. In 2001 to around 2007, in provision of the reliable service, we have been providing, collecting the data very well, and having to provide basic services like the rainfall today, tomorrow, minimum and maximum temperatures, and also providing outlook. And providing from 2007, one of the things that we've noticed is that it does not help to only provide that information of saying that it's going to be cold, it's going to be raining, we need to be cold. The question is, so what? And one of the areas that we started to look at is the disaster risk reduction. Working very closely with the National Disaster Management Center in saying, how do we go about making sure that this information is understood by the people, especially when it comes to severe weather events, and also having to provide alerts to the people. How do we work together in ensuring your technical people and ours, they have an understanding? And we started to come up with application like severe weather guidance warning, and that program we started in South Africa with some of the few countries in the SADC region. And now in the SADC region, all the SADC countries, we work together in ensuring that, because what happens in, let's say in Mozambique, there are floods, the water comes to us. And if we do not understand what is happening in Mozambique, we will have a problem here at home. So we have a system that was developed, and that goes beyond maximum minimum temperature of saying the forecasters, they put and talk. We also have a website of saying things are going bad in your area. What might happen in our own area? Oh, this is what we see. This is what we think we need to be doing on your side. And that has helped some of the countries in the SADC region, but mostly also on our side. And I think the other area, Chair, we have been having, we've got some infrastructure. And with that infrastructure, I'm proud to say, when we started around 2007, if you look at our balance sheet as an institution, our asset base were around 200 and something million. Now our asset base is around half a billion. So the countries actually invested in the organization. Those in 2007 were given funds to upgrade all our radios. Were given 240 million. Hence, you could see that our asset base has gone up, so that we've got better technology to do the work. I've divided these years at 2007 to 2012. It was an area where we say, okay, we've got this infrastructure that has been enhanced, the technology has been enhanced. How do we then use that and we go beyond providing that data of the data and basic services? How do we go beyond that and make the information into some knowledge? And we tested this working closely with the disaster management, because it's one area where people need to really be informed when the severe weather events are going to happen. Working closely with them, establish a multi-hazard early warning system and having our own input in there as the weather service. And also in areas where even the local government, where they need to have their disaster management plan, our team is also part of that. And our forecasters are working closely with the National Disaster Management Center. What we also identified together with the disaster management is that South Africa, we tend to have severe droughts. It's either we have severe droughts or we have heavy rains. And we tend to have, when there's flooding, there's flash flooding. And it's one of the dangers that we have. So we worked with the National Disaster Management. We had an MOU with them. Although we didn't have the funds to come up with a system, the department funded us with that, but we came with the knowledge and we came up with a South African flash flood guidance system. Now we're using this information that dates 150 years, the data itself, into coming up with the services and products that we're talking about now. And also we also looked at modernizing the infrastructure that we have, so that we can have the reliable weather service, where some of our monitoring weather stations were manual. We moved to modernization of those and automation of those stations, which worked very well for us and improved the confidence. Beyond 2012 and 2015, Chair and members, there is a move now, because the end users are saying we don't only need that information of maximum and minimum. The question is, so what? If you are saying there is going to be a severe weather, so what? So they want us to provide impact forecasting. For example, if we are doing an outlook saying to some of the farmers, it seems like for the last 4 or 5 years, it has been very dry. Now we're going to start having rains. we should be working proper or lose animal health. We should be having models that are saying, okay, which of these diseases they take a certain pattern in terms of their the outbreak, and saying that, okay, it has been very dry, you should be now making sure that you vaccinate early enough. It's not enough to say it's going to be raining. You need to be vaccinating for certain diseases. For example, China, our move is to provide services to the different sectors, to agriculture, to water, to energy, to health, in a specific way that what they need. I'll give you an example. We're starting now not to only employ forecasters and climatologists. We are also looking at people who've got a combination of agriculture and agro-meteorologists, people who have that kind of training, people who've got training on hydro, and also, and that has helped us because we start to come up with products that will assist the farm. I'll use the example of agromet. With the farmers, with the dairy farming, there is a project that we've been working on where we can assist farmers to manage the risk to plan. One of the projects is called Temperature Humidity Index, where advisory service, where we provide the farmers with this information. It does help them because when the humidity is high, the cows might not produce very well. So you do your planning, then you look at the kind of feed that you need to give to the animals, provision of water and all that as a farmer. That information goes beyond minimum and maximum temperatures. Also for the crop farming, there is another service or advisory service that you come up with, going degree days, where a farmer can have the information, advising them when is the right time to start plowing so that you can get better production, other than just giving them the outlook. So this is some of the work when it comes to reliable weather services and also, and especially for that public good part. Coming to the commercial part, Chairperson, we also moving in that direction. It's very interesting that the different sectors, but we're still learning of what is required by the end users there, where we also commercialize. When we started, more than 70% of our funding was coming from as part of the parliamentary grant. But now, it's close to 50-50, the commercial revenue and also the government grant. It's almost 50-50. But it's an industry that, it's an area that we are starting to get in, having a better understanding and all that. We have divided it into regulated and non-regulated. I'll come to the regulated part when I talk about the aeronautical and marine. It's also interesting with the commercial honorable members is that we start to work with mining and they've got different needs. When we work with construction, they have different needs. So it's also starting to learn and build the knowledge that will also assist in policy making in some of the areas because it's a new area. The team just recently have started. They've worked with the building industry, where construction industry and the building industry, where some of the companies are manufacturing bricks, and they want information in a certain way. And we are starting to learn about that and coming with those specific products for them, and then generating revenue. We're looking at that. Coming to providing aeronautical. And your aeronautical, I always say, nobody can take off. If you are flying, the pilot cannot take off without getting the information from the weather service. While in the air, you still need that information. When you land, you still need that information. It's for planning and also for managing the fuel use. And it has got also indirect input in terms of managing carbon emission. The information that we provide. That part is actually regulated. We provide services to aviation. We also provide services to marine. with aviation chair, from 2001, when we started with aviation, the services before 2001, they were getting the services without paying for the services. Then with the new act, the ATARAF that they need to pay, because they are commercial institutions. And also in that, we are governed by the International Civil Aviation on how we provide this information. So it's also a compliance issue for us here in South Africa. We are being monitored, honorable members, by OCAIO. They come and look at how we are providing that service, because the issue is the safety of skies. So they come and audit South Africa. In 2007, members, the audit
was done. To assist you, CEO, when you mention abbreviations, don't take it for granted that we know what they mean. That is OCAIO.
Oh, okay. It is International Civil Aviation Organization, which all the members, it's a UN body that is responsible to look at safety of skies, looking at aviation safety. South Africa, we are also the members of that as well. And through the Department of Transport. So South African Weather Service, we also need to be supporting the Department of Transport when it comes to aviation, working closely with the civil aviation as well. For example, if there are any accidents that happen, and most of the time the accidents are due to weather conditions, we are expected as the South African Weather Service to provide, to do the investigation and give the information to civil aviation of really what happened that day in that area in terms of the weather conditions. So we also have that responsibility as the Weather Service. So that is also another area that is very important for us, and also at an international level, which I'll continue to talk about it in the next slide. We also have been given recently another responsibility to work together with the department looking in provision of air quality services. And this responsibility we've acquired recently. One of the responsibilities for the Weather Service, we are managing the monitoring stations, all the monitoring stations that are owned by the National Department, monitor them, making sure that the data that comes out of those monitoring stations is quality data. It meets the standards. We do the monitoring as well. And one of the things that we have been busy with at the moment is to ensure that we work very closely also with the municipalities. Chair, one of the things that we have identified is an area where the Weather Service, we can also add value, because we have been having the skill as an organization in managing monitoring stations for weather. So that skill has been transferred also to air quality. And one of the areas of adding value is to work closely with the municipality. As you indicated, Chair, that there are also challenges there. We have been approaching different municipalities. We're having discussions with some of the municipalities to have MOUs where we provide training and capacity building for the people that they have in that area. For example, we have a discussion with Ekurhuleni municipalities to have an MOU with them. Tswana, we've already finalized the MOU. City of Johannesburg, we had a number of discussions on how we can work together there. Mpumalanga Provincial Department of Agriculture and Rural Development, we're also having discussions with them. So we are starting to say, how do we work together and integrate, and making sure that we get better information and training of the people as well. We also have the responsibility of the collection of the met and ambient quality information. And also the other area which is important, which I mentioned, is the long-term custodian of this information. So we need to have skills in making sure that information is quality information, it's the records are kept, and moving with the information for the weather service that dates 150 years, we, some of the things were written on paper, and I think better to digitalize that information. So it's one of the programs that we have to digitalize the information that dates years ago. And also if for other responsibilities that we have, it's around collecting the information around the Southern Ocean. And share that the area that we also need to be proud of as the country. We are monitoring the second biggest area of the ocean after America. So we've got that bigger responsibility. And also the good thing is that we are working with also other countries like America in making sure that we are monitoring the area very well and providing the information that is required. I will come to the international obligations, Chair. As a national meteorological service, we also have international obligations where our government has signed under some of the conventions of the UN. One of them is the Meteorological World Meteorological Organization. The WMO. With the WMO, we have before 1994, Chair, we were removed as a member because of apartheid, and then immediately after 1994, we were invited back in as a member. And I must say, over that period, the country, we have moved faster in taking the leadership position in that area. For example, we are a regional telecommunication hub because we, as net services, we all need to share information for us to come up with this model. So South Africa has got a responsibility to collect all, to get all the information from this observation network in Africa from all the English-speaking countries. We've got that responsibility. We are a telecommunication hub for that, and also regional specialized meteorological center where there are special programs or projects that need to be done for the continent. South African Weather Service is the institution that has been identified to do that work and coordinate and having funds to do that work. For example, I was talking about the flash flood guidance system that we developed for South Africa. Then the WMO together came up with the proposal to say that we need to do that for the whole SADC. And the project was funded. Now we've got a flash flood guidance system for the whole area of SADC. We are also responsible for global as a global producing center for the long-range forecasting for also the farmers. And I'm also proud that with the advancement in technology, South African Weather Service has also been identified as a satellite center of excellence, looking at satellites that are monitoring atmospheric activities and related to weather. And we have the regional training center. And also we've got the Global Atmospheric Watch, which is here in Cape Town. There are only three stations here in Africa. One is in Algeria, and another one is in Kenya. And ours is actually one that is doing really well, working with the other centers as well. And we were requested recently, in the last 5-6 years, that International Civil Aviation wanted all main services that are providing service to aviation for the issue of safety, that they must have a quality management system in place by 2010. And we are one of the first countries, not only in Africa, but in the whole world to have the total quality management in place. Other countries, they've just got a quality management for just aviation. Weather service, we are accredited for the total. And now what is happening is that working with other institutions to share that, to ensure that Africa's got safe skies, because this can be used as an area of saying, Africa, we are not safe because we cannot prove that the service that we provide is quality service. Moving to, let's go back, civil aviation. Looking at civil aviation, we also have an obligation with that one, with Convention of the International Civil Aviation Organization. One of our mandates, which is different from other countries, is that the South African Weather Service is also responsible as the Met Authority. We monitor all the airports as an authority to check whether the automatic weather stations that they have there, they meet the requirements, they meet the requirements of the Civil Aviation Organization. Then we report to the Civil Aviation. And before 2007, that structure was part of the structure of the Weather Service. And then an audit was done by Civil Aviation Organization. There was only one finding for the Weather Service, was that we need to separate the Met Authority from the services that we provide. And that has happened. We've got a separate unit, Met Authority, and also starting to employ people that are supporting the Met Authority. On a year-to-year basis, we monitor all the efforts, provide that information to Civil Aviation that gives comfort in terms of safety. So that finding is closed for the country. Moving to the next one, in terms of our mandate. This one is a provision of services that are sensitive to the demographic realities of the country. This one, there are a number of activities in there that we as an organization we are busy with. For example, looking at the issue of
our sister with time giving me 30 minutes left.
30 minutes. Thank you, Chair. But I think that's the part that we need to. With this area, Chair, we looked at it very closely. One, as indicated in the past, people from previous disadvantaged, it's a field that people will never really understand it or being exposed to it in terms of also career development. Within the organization, looking at our equity numbers, we looked at coming up with a program, a bursary program, where we looked at some of the kids, young people from previously disadvantaged to come into the field. And I must say, we have moved in terms of our equity. For example, we've got 67% African, around 24% white, around less than 10% Indians, and also 3% Indians and colored. But the issue is that we made a conscious decision to have bursaries, and 75% of those bursaries were looking at previously disadvantaged. And the other area was women. Those who also do not have women in the field. We said in terms of our strategy, we will have 50-50 to attract 50% young ladies and 50% young gentlemen. At the moment, within the organization, with our equity, we've got 60% males and 40% females. It's an area that we are looking at it very closely. And there are a number of projects now, Chair, that we're looking at in terms of making sure that we are sensitive to the demographic, to harness the indigenous knowledge. I don't know whether the members have, we have done some research and we've come up with a book, Rainbow in the Mist, on indigenous knowledge. Probably we might have to print some of books to provide to also the members. the other area that is important for us, we've come up with a terminology book of the terms, the weather terms, and that book is being translated into Setswana, Sethosa, and the others, the other seven languages. And also, we want to continuously enhance that the indigenous knowledge that we have. Probably we'll do the second in the next 5 years, look at doing some more research and coming up with a second book, looking at this area. Moving to the next one. Yeah, Chaperson, I think with this slide, for us to do that mandate, we have to look at the acts, the priorities of the country, national developmental plan, looking at national friendship programs, and looking at critical and skilled skills in also in the area. One of the key pillars for our work is the National Climate Change Response Policy in support of the department. Safe scientific capability, and also looking at aviation and disaster risk reduction, as I've shared in the first few slides. Chair, we've shared this before in terms of the how we are responding to the imperative. We have a number of chapters that we are responding to in terms of the national developmental plan. From 2007, from 2001 to 2007, it was more of the establishment, 2007 to 2012 consolidation. Now it's more of making sure that the organization is sustainable, and we cannot do that without collaboration and partnership and having relevant projects moving forward that will address some of the challenges that we have that have been presented and shared. Like, for example, the issue that we're talking around the FIT. Chair, let me come to the next issue, the National Framework for Climate Services. Chairperson has indicated climate change is the challenge, but then we need to be supporting in terms of providing the service that is actually required for that. One of the things that we have also noticed is that we've got a number of players, different players, that are out there that are having this information. Other academic institutions, others it's the Met Service, others are research institutions, and probably some private institutions as well. But one of the challenges, Chair, that you said we are faced with, as indicated, weather knows no boundaries. And if you look in our continent, there is a lack in terms of infrastructure, technical human capital, institutional capacity is also required. If you look at Africa, look at Africa. The south, it's in the southern part where things are much, much better, but there is a lot of work that needs to be done within the continent, which actually means there are gaps when it comes to doing modeling in doing research. Because with weather information, you don't only depend on the weather information that is coming from your own country. You need to know what's happening way before it happens. So that is an area that is a challenge that goes beyond South Africa. However, if you look at South Africa, as indicated, with the investment that the government has done over the period, we are in a better position than the other countries. However, what is happening is that the provision of this information is a little bit fragmented. So hence, we come together with the department, coming up with a national framework of climate services so that the information is coordinated and we get better enhancement of that information. The WMO in September 2009, during the World Climate Conference, agreed that for us to be in a position to do this as countries, we need to come up with a global framework for climate services. And each country comes with its own national framework. The purpose was to the rationale for it, and the aim was to strengthen the production and the availability and the delivery of that service, and coming up with the applications that are important. The rationale as well, to make sure that we provide the information tools for adaptation, and also providing the climate services for decision making, to engage, and also the access to that information. One of the issues that came out shows that you find that science-based institutions, they don't have interface platform to interact with the end user. We do the science and then we go to the end user. So the approach was to say, let's involve the end user from the beginning. Working with the department is an area that we are really working on that. And the areas you're looking at those areas, looking at the user interface, climate service information, as the next one again, where information is all over in the country, try to put it in one place, and then use that to come up with a service that is useful to the end user. Observation networks, encompassing that is an area that needs a continuous investment in it. Yes, as the weather service, our asset base now is $500 million, but we need to continuously invest there because technologies, they also do change. The other area, Chair and members, is the research area, modeling and prediction. We need to continuously build in that area. The other one is capacity development and also making sure that we've got the people to do that. So all those, all together, they should be user interface in making sure that climate service information is there, monitoring as well, and observation. You spoke about that as well. The next one. We also work very closely with the department. The National Framework for Climate Services and the National Climate Change Response Policies are really aligned, and we are feeding into that. For example, if you look at long-term adaptation scenarios, the Weather Service, in terms of the research work that we do climate scenarios. For example, now we started to interact with the provinces because we've done climate scenarios for the provinces. So what it means to assist the provinces to come up with their plans, they need to have such understanding. But there is a need to integrate that kind of work. Next, if you go to that impact analysis, this is how this national framework will assist, having all this information for the different sectors, looking at impacts of changes, looking at the scenario, looking at impact, coming up with adaptation plans on how to deal with that. So that is also our role as the Weather Service, working with the department. These are the different phases of the whole plan. I will not go into detail on that one. And the plan, which you will be monitoring on how far we are. We've got this as part of our plan, and also it's part of the department, as part of the delivery process. We have worked with the different stakeholders. We also have the support, which I forgot to talk about. In 2007, we established a Meteorological Association of Southern Africa. All the Met services are a member of that. We, South Africa, we are the secretariat, and we are hosting that Meteorological Association of South Africa, where Met services in the Southern region, they come up with a strategy working together. So that we are working together and making sure they also have their own national policies. This one is going to be, we need to be promoting collaborative culture and policy alignment. These are some of, and I've mentioned here when I talked about policy interface and institutional arrangements, they are needed for that. Modeling and inter-institutional collaboration on outreach, on how we also work with the end users as a collective. we need social scientists to work with. The future, we need to be building a sector-specific capacity and capability in dealing with issues of climate change. And also, there is a need for innovation as well. Chair, this is one of the areas where you also have a lot of passion, and we believe that if we move with this in the next 10 to 15 years, we would be in a position to have a capable and competent team that can work with the technologies that are coming and making sure that the communities are able to deal with severe weather events and also being able to deal with issues of also air quality. Chairperson, this we also get from this information. If you look at how youth, we've got a challenge in terms of youth who's unemployed and also having the necessary skills, and we trust that as an organization, we need to look at this area and see how can we capacitate our youth and making sure that we've got skills and knowledgeable workforce with the necessary expertise in the field. Next one. We came up with this national educational plan, having discussions also with the department on how to go about this. The purpose of this is to address the shortage of required skills in science-related fields, specifically for climate, weather impact, climate risk, and air quality. So we had interaction, we did some desk research to see what would be required maybe in the next 10 years. Looking at the Vision 2020, how do we then support the National Development Plan as well? Looking specifically at capacity building, the framework itself. What we've also looked at, these are some of the documents that we looked at as we try to address the issue of shortage of skills. One of the challenges that we are faced with in South Africa when it comes to severe weather related disasters, we need to have skilled people who are residing, who are there with the local people to be able to assist. And I think because we have a shortage of skilled people in the area, we find that when it comes to those areas where people really need this support, we don't have the necessary skills that are required. And as indicated, shortage of skills, looking at climate variability and extreme weather. These are the chapters this plan will be linked to within the National Development Plan. Let's move to the worried of time. We have come up with this plan, Chair. We did some desktop. We talked to some of the municipalities. We talked to a number of universities that are providing the service as stakeholders. I've got a list of the stakeholders that we spoke to. And we did ask, how many do you think you'll need in the next 10 years? How many you need in the as we move over the period? And this is a conservative growth check. We might have to go back and look at this, but we wanted to look at it as a pilot and see how can we work together trying to build the skills. For example, in the next 10 to 15 years, we need to have at least 162 climatologists, 232 meteorologists, and maybe more than 144 air quality. What we do have at the moment, as a weather service only, we've got 12 climatologists, 112 meteorologists, and 13 air quality specialists. So there is a need to really grow and build that capacity. The plan that you have, members, is looking at meteorologist, climatologist, air quality, agromet, hydromet, health specialists that work with the weather people, early warning and disaster management, because they also need to have their own forecasters in that area. People who've got an understanding of alternative energy, oceanographers, people that have an understanding of what's happening in the ocean and working also with marine. For example, with marine, we and coastal service, we work very closely with within the department with ocean and coast. We have developed a strategy that is linked to Operation Purchaser, but that strategy is a combined strategy between us and also the department. And the board has just approved the strategy. Next. The project plan check, the first phase was to engage the stakeholders. That part has been done. We've also engaged the Department of Education. There is a buy-in from the Department of Education. What we've also done, we've also elevated these skills as critical skills of the country, because in the past they have not been identified as such. That is another thing that we've done. Now, phase two, 16-17, is to look at resource mobilization, where we can get funding from all over to fund this. And then phase three is to start the implementation. These are the stakeholders that have been identified that we started to work with: Department of Higher Education, Department of Basic Education. Department of Basic Education, one of the challenges that we have is that when we started with the Quasari program, we couldn't get people, enough people who've got science and math. And we need to start engaging at that level. Department of Science and Technology, Department of Environmental Affairs, Water Affairs, Agriculture. These are some water research councils, agricultural research, ARC, University of Pretoria, KwaZulu-Natal University, Zululand, also the other university, Forte. What we've also done, Che, we've in the past, the universities that have been in the rural areas in this field, they have not been playing a bigger role. We started by engaging them, having MOUs with them, and making sure that we give bursaries to students to go and do atmospheric science studies in other universities, also looking at agromet, universities of Forte, Zululand University, where we're also starting to look at those universities, local government, and probably working with the private sector. These are the funds. It's an educated estimate of the funds that will be required to really try to get these people to for the qualification. Progress, we've managed to get the endorsement at a number of levels and submission to also the Department of Education. The team is also doing some further research in saying, really, is this an conservative estimate. If we're to really dig deep, how much do we need, or how many do we need in terms of the numbers for the country? In conclusion, Chair, the Weather Service is an institution that is there to make sure that we save property and life, and also make sure that we are the implementing agency of the department. But going beyond that, we are an implementation agency for the country. As indicated with my presentation, our services are going across the board. But we cannot do that without really a collaboration. It's an area that, and coordination, it's an area that I think we also need to be developing skills from internal and leveraging on capability and capacity of also other institutions other than the weather service and going strongly in terms of resource mobilization, because this needs funds to do the work and continued monitoring and evaluation of the work that we do. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much. I've got a secretary here who gives me this. Then she says I must wait for a class. Thank you very much for the presentation. Just a rider. Linda, as you started trying to detail what we have achieved and what we are doing in each area of our mandate, you went to town. Unfortunately, that going to town is not in the document. Can we then agree that you will send us those details? Send us those details, because those are very important details. 201 to 207, 207 to 2012, 2012 to 2015. That's very, very important for us to understand where you are, to understand what you have done, both for the public good matters and also in the commercial space, what we have been able to do and what is the room for improvement in those. Again, under your aviation, also you said a lot, and your marine, you said a lot. Please give us, under your ambient air quality sciences, you said a lot. Just give us those details. But also, as a reliable partner in the regional space, you have given us enough information from your word of mouth. But from what is written here, you are not promoting yourself to us. You are not telling us all the good work that you are doing and how much you are held in respect by the continent and by the world community and by the various bodies that are authorities in the space where you operate, whether it be the World Meteorological Organization or the Civil Aviation Organization, all of them. So you and again, what the responsibilities have they given to you? So if you can please give us those details so that we are at almost at the same level in terms of information with what basically you or with yourselves and with other people working in this sector, because we'll be working in this sector at least for the next remaining 4 years until 2019. We are here. Now we must ask you very pertinent questions for what you have given us. So that's the problem when you are being oversighted. You need to give people information so that they can use that information. We're almost like a court of law. To make sure that you achieve the goals that you set for yourself. Colleagues, we have had in the presentation any takers on questions of clarity or any other questions or any other inputs. Platform is yours. Honorable Makube.
Chair, just two issues. Thanks for the presentation. At least now I may not be like many other South Africans who thought that your major task is providing the minimum and maximum. So now I'm a better person. But just on that point, what are you doing to ensure that the people out there don't continue to view you as such? Because
really that's the information they can identify with, and you are known for that. Some don't even know necessarily as to who is providing this information. They think it's the Chili people. So they may not know that it's you behind that, you know. So I'm saying, how do you market yourself? How do you ensure that you tell people? But then the second point will be that a lot is being said about the continental and regional infrastructure that is found wanting. Understandably so, perhaps. In as much as we are upping our game as source in South Africa, but also going beyond our borders on the basis of what may result from us not doing anything to assist regional countries as well as the continent, ensuring that we've got clear skies. My issue will be, to what extent is the other countries upping the game, making sure that at some point, like when we project, saying in the country in terms of the critical skills that we need for climatologists, meteorologists, and all of that. Yeah. I'm saying, if we say 10 to 15 years, this is the educational plan we want to do, let's take that kind of a scenario to the regional and continental level. To what extent are they saying, come 2030, come 2050, we will be there, so that we don't continue to carry everybody or the burden on our shoulders, simply because the others are not doing enough, recognizing the agency and the need to do this. And so I'm just saying, to me that would be important. It may not necessarily be not to work with all the answers, but let's work towards that if there's not much to push them to make sure that at some point they do their part.
No,
thanks. I think we welcome the presentation. Just a few questions of clarity. One is around the source as an accredited regional training center. When you talk regional training center, I mean for Southern Africa. We just want to get more information as to what is the response of Africa, both East, West, in relation to regional training. And what is your input and what is your output? Secondly, will be around so your global. I hope that is not an unfair question. You are a global player, and as a country, we are pushing an African agenda. So now we've got 54 countries, African countries plus one, newly established South Sudan. I just want to check to what extent, out of that 54. How many are participating in the global arena? For example, in the other programs of the department, like waste, only 27 countries are participating in the Kiamato or whatever. I just want just to get the figure. Now, you also have a responsibility around aviation safety. Now, one of the problems has been fatal accident aviation in the country where the victims are private pilots and private owners. To what extent do they interface with source? I mean, those who are owning private jets, one person, two flight, etc. To what extent are they interfacing with you in line with what your mandate is? Before any flight departs, you interact. Now, now with regard to the, that will be your commercial, but the private one, I just want to get it. Not because I've got a friend who is owning a private jet, but just to know, are they interacting with you so that maybe we minimize accidents and so forth. The disaster management. How ready are our regions or our districts in as far as disaster management is concerned? And then lastly, it will be, yeah, this will also concern your SWWS, your severe weather warning for the districts. How are they ready to respond to that? Your maritime. You are also having a responsibility for maritime weather forecasting services. And you talk about the vast ocean around southern Africa. Now, your counterparts dealing with oceans and coast, Dr. Mike, says brief us in the portfolio committee around Antarctica. So I would like just to know source. You have not mentioned Antarctica. Are you also covering Antarctica? I just want to know that because it is going to be an issue that through the chair, this portfolio committee is going to be seized to. Because there are dynamics around Antarctica. Lastly, it will be around your skills development. We know that a lot of you are working with universities. There are a number of students who are just doing general DSC and so forth. I just want to check, are you not then trying to divert them, those who are just doing pure PSC, to be attracted to your meteorology and so forth? That will be around your skills development. How far is your technology development, which is one of your key focus areas? Thank you, Jay.
It's a broad question, and I think if you can answer it, Judy must come in and answer. The issue, we have all these monitoring stations, but you can tell us how many. You should have a sense, because you are responsible for them, though they belong to the department. We have them all over the place. We have visited some of them. They record your PM, your NOx, your SOx. The issue that we want to take with you and the department, all of you put together, is we can't be putting all these instruments for the sake of putting them. Including your information, where you put even the information that you get was seconds. Where you store that information that you get from all these machines, your monitoring stations, from government, whether they are local government or they are from here. What really perplexes us is that you have got all these monitoring stations, but there is no desire, no aim on your part to apportion blame to those that these machines find are responsible for the woes of our people, public health of our people. We have not even started to get closer to the countries because we are saying, hey, it's an airshed, you know, it's a call horse there. So everybody is throwing in. Now, why put those machines when the intention is not to get to the actual people who are messing us up? We know for now they are unable to. We know for now there is an apportionment study in the Val area that again is taking too long. When are we going to apportion blame, use this instrument appropriately for, in my view, for the intended use? Because we have put them in there not just to know what's happening, have a general view that the asset is okay, standards are okay. Those that are going beyond the standards, let's come closer to them, even come with this mobile, whatever, machines, come closer to hyper steel. If we are doubting that hyper steel that is causing this PM high levels in our machines, by when? I know it's not by when are we going to apportion, so that we don't have, and we're using so much, we are told that this instrument, the machines, the modern machines are over $1 million just to buy them. Now I don't include the maintenance cost. Now we can't be investing all this money and we don't stop the culprits from messing up with our lives. When will we get to that stage? Now, whatever you say, rest assured, it will be held against you. The second issue, you have talked about the skills that are needed by the country. But those skills, you have told us how many you have. How many do we have in the country, even in industry? Those skills that we say we need, because some of the skills that you are talking about that are now residing with industry were stolen from you. So in totality, because again we can't just be looking at these skills and we can't zoom into even industry itself, make some approximation of what industry might need, because they also have to adhere to these standards that we have set, therefore they need these skills. They need these skills. They can't adhere to these standards unless they have these skills. They've got people who can advise them. Therefore you need more than what you have here. Your approximation of your whatever, on page or whatever, 32 might be too conservative, to say the least. So if we can just have a sense. But having said all that, I think looking at the work that you do, there's no reason for us to believe that this is work in the public good. There is no way that we can have safe skies. By the way, many of these members, let me speak for them now, many of these members are going to fly home today after this meeting. And on Monday night, in fact, they fly twice a week, home and back to work. You see, other people are using taxis. These are using aeroplanes to come to work. So, therefore, for their sake, we must thank you, because you keep our skies quite wonderful, and we can rely on the safety of the aeroplanes as we board them and as we alight from them. So we should thank you, and therefore, if there is any challenge of whatever nature in this area of work, don't hesitate to come to us. It's in our interest too. Apart from it being in the interest of the country. Because once the country, you remember that the country that lost an aeroplane. Look, whole aeroplane got lost. Malaysia, H3, whatever, something. I don't know. I heard that some parts were found recently this week somewhere. After a year, now, again, there are so many. In fact, Malaysia has had this terrible incident, I think twice or so. Many people are now afraid of getting on those planes. They are very afraid. I won't get on any plane reaching Malaysia, rest assured. I won't. Definitely, I won't. Eh? Yes. So, but I will get on any plane reaching SAA. I can tell seen it. Even when we have got serious difficulties, I think we do advise them and they are able to lend wherever they lend. But we should thank you for all this wonderful work you do in this area of work. So you can respond. By the way, you need not respond to everything. Some of the answers you might not have with you now. Some you still have to give us whatever that you said to us so that we are fully informed. Julie, are you the first one?
Chair, I think perhaps the CEO should start and then I can come in where the CEO would like me to support.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. There are a number of questions that I've got the whole team to also assist in allocating. I think the question around marketing and educating communities, Dr. Matopen, may you please take that one of the initiatives that we have around that area. The regional training center, the questions around that, I will take those. Looking at the continental infrastructure, I will also take that one. Mr. Ndabambi, disaster management, how ready are the provinces? And also, may you also take the other one, the severe weather one, the marine, the question on marine Antarctica. The skills development, the basic BSc, and how we are tapping into that. I'll take that, and probably Kanyisa, you will add to that one. Chair, I think the question around SAGWIC is I'll take part of it, and then Judy will be taking over in terms of responding to those questions. And around the skills, I will take that with if there is any part that I've left, Kanyisa, I would like you to also maybe add. Chairperson, starting with, I'll take the questions for SAGWIC, for the air quality, Chairperson. I think the responsibility, when we started looking at the totality of this project, with the monitoring work that we do, we've got 108 stations that we monitor on behalf of the department, and the majority of those stations, they really provide the necessary data and its quality data, which is a good thing. But I think one of the areas, because this work has been also, we've been looking at it in phases, and phase one was to really make sure the stations that are there are functioning well. We've got that part. Then phase two, I think, is the phase that Judy will talk about, and also the attribution studies, and what it is that we need to do, and by when, because the monitoring part is also to do look into that. From our side, Chair, we are working very closely with the department in making sure what we have in terms of monitoring, it meets the required standard. But you are right, we need to be looking at attribution, but that Judy will really look into that. And then the other question, Chair, that has been raised is around the skills. I will not be in a position at the moment to provide information of how many that are needed by the private sector. And one of the reasons is that in the past, you'll find that insurance industry started to need more of these skills and for them to manage that risk. Now you find that now, for example, Coca-Cola was saying first top risk is climate change. So now you're starting to get other industries starting to want more of these services. I think as we move forward, we need to do those investigations to look at that. And you are right, the plan that we've put in place is a very conservative plan at the moment. There will be more that will need to be done, because even if you look at the figures, what we did, we looked at the hotspots in terms of the municipalities where there are bigger problems, not looking in throughout South Africa when we look at, for example, the air quality requirements. that is one of the things that we need to continuously do more research on it. The question around being around the skills again, honorable members asked whether what is it that we are doing in terms of those that people have done basic BS3. We identify that people who've done basic BS3, when we recruit them to join the weather service, within a short space of time, they move and do something else. So now we said, instead, because in the beginning, when we were giving bursaries, we were giving bursaries to people who've done BS3. Then there was a bridging course for a year, and then they do the MET. But now what we are doing, from high school, we take them to do BS3 in MET, instead of just doing a simple BS3, so that we also stop that gap year, and we know that we've hooked them from the beginning, instead of, because the person will come for a year and say, no, I still have an opportunity to do something else in terms of my BS3. So we have identified that. So all the bursaries that we give now, it's BSc in meteorology. That is a requirement, and they must have maths and science. And most people they think you need to have geography, but we need maths and science. Geography is just an added advantage. So that's been the approach that we're taking. When it comes to the technologies that we are having, we are trying as an organization to really move with the technology. And I must say also thank our government. If you look at what we do as the weather service, we also doing a lot of work around modeling. And when you do modeling, you need high performance computer. Our government has given us funds to have that infrastructure, the high performance computing. And also, if you look at our radars, it's the new technology around the radars. If you look at our automatic weather station, it's also the new technology. And we're starting to combine a number of different technologies. For example, we have mentioned that we are a center of, or we have been recognized as a center of excellence by UMetSat around a satellite technology. And what we are doing now, we're mixing the satellite technology with the radar technology to actually do the prediction. That is also an area that needs more investment, and also in terms of capacity as well. It's an area that is evolving. Like we had one of the things that we need to monitor the atmosphere going up, and using radar sondes, we realized that we have a challenge in terms of they were very expensive. We have a relationship with FAA, where as they fly, they collect, we've got the software in their planes, they collect the data for us. So trying to combine different technologies. The lightning technologies that we have, we are looking at other ways that are also a little bit cheaper, and also doing some training on that. With the rain, automatic rain station, we're looking at how we can combine the information that is not even, some is collected by us and also collected by other institutions. So we started to look for partners to assist us with that as well. And also different dissemination platforms. We have just signed a contract with a partner where they're going to be using the mobile technology better to provide the information to our people. Because one of the things, the majority of us, we do have phones. So we need to have platforms to use the phone, whether it's an iPhone or any other phone, to be in a position to disseminate the information. Then moving to being a global player, we are, and the African agenda, as a global player within the WMO, African countries, almost 54 of them, almost all of them, they are member of the WMO. But the challenge that we have is some 33 of them that are active and paying their contribution. The others are
not. It's now 13 minutes past 11.
All right.
Wow, fast. We have another presentation.
Okay. So they are really active, but the other countries, the challenge that they have is the contribution. So they cannot vote. But in terms of sharing the information and working together, in the continent, when it comes to infrastructure, five of the countries out of those 55 really would say are really the best within the continent. South Africa, Kenya, Morocco, Egypt, Nigeria, we're playing a bigger role than the others. They follow. The other thing around the infrastructure, in the SADC region, all the messages in the SADC region, we've formed a Meteorological Association of Southern Africa, and we've got a strategy on how to identify the weaknesses in terms of human capital and infrastructure. We've got a strategy. We've just appointed a director who's going to go around and look for resource mobilization, look for funding to assist the other countries. There's also a strategy for the whole Africa that has been endorsed by ministers responsible for mass service, which the AU is looking at, which we're also playing an important role. Chairperson, let me give to the other members to also respond. Maybe before we get, let me give it to Judy.
Thanks, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I think the question really is around this issue of attribution of responsibility, evolution responsibility. And Chair, here, what I just wanted to do was to separate three quite distinct areas of work. The one area of work that SOARS is leading us is on the monitoring of ambient air quality. The second area of work is the monitoring and enforcement of compliance with minimum emission standards by industry. It's a separate set of monitoring stations that monitors the emissions from the stacks, as opposed to monitoring of the overall ambient air quality in an area. And then I think the third area, is the third question that honourable members have been raising is this question of dipsticking and understanding the kind of health impacts that communities are experiencing from the severity of air pollution within their areas. And so the ambient air quality monitoring is where we're trying to use studies to do this attribution of within a priority area, understanding where the greatest source of problem is coming from. But that can only be used in conjunction with the direct emission monitoring, the monitoring from the stacks. We can't use those separately. We can't only depend on the ambient air quality monitoring. The actual compliance and enforcement actions which are taken by the Environmental Monitoring Inspectorate and the Environmental Monitoring Inspectors, some of which are at national level, some of which are at provincial level, and some of which are at local level, and yet we agree that there are insufficient of those inspectors. Those inspectors are primarily dependent on the data that is coming from the stacks in particular. In terms of the dip-sticking, I think that's a further area of discussion, and that's where we would like to present at some point the research strategy that we have developed around right across the spectrum, and not only through ourselves, but using also other institutions to understand the health impacts and to put a cost-benefit analysis attached to those health impacts. I hope I'm clear.
Yeah, not, but we will leave you for now until you come and present. Because you'll understand where we come from. If we don't become a little bit harder on you, at any rate, even if, you know, Makhubela was raising another matter with me, saying, you know, the department has said that they would like to go to an area that has not been industrialized and do some research there, look at the economy, look at the ecosystem, look at public health there, then go to an area that has been industrialized. Now, it made sense. I think somebody said that to us from your department. But we know that that has not been done. That has not been done up to this far. Therefore, you cannot do comparison. Secondly, we also know that there has not been this appreciation by the demand, immaterial of whether you are measuring steps or whatever. You have things that you call hotspots. Yourselves. It's not us who gave those areas these names. And it goes without say that having said that these are hotspots, we don't know when you gave them these names, you yourself should have gone there and ascertained what has been the health or what has been the impact of such pollutants in those areas to our people, to the ecosystem and everything else. Now, that's why I'm saying I hear you, but I don't hear you. Hopefully you'll come back with a better explanation as a department. But from where we are seated, we are not happy at all. We are not happy at all. We can't be happy if we represent our people. There's no way that we can be happy. If you are saying this is too costly, go and partner with another department called health. We can assist you. That department is called health. Go and partner with them and go and partner with another one called agriculture. Go and partner with another one called economic department. So that we zoom deeper into the impact of these matters. So that maybe there could also be another tax that can come from treasury. So that these people who are messing up our people's lives, indeed, we know that there are punitive measures that we put in. We don't even know what is the impact of those punitive, of 5 million, whether it is any organization that ever paid 5 million for at all. But even those 5 million for people who are making billions, what is 5 million? Now, we don't want you to speak now. You will speak when we give you an opportunity, when you come to us, just to answer comprehensively. But again, not to say that we are still planning. Don't come to tell us, yes, we did not do it, now we are going to do it, this is how we are going to do it. And these are our partners. Because up to now, he has been speaking like politicians, Judy. And, you know, politicians, you know, I don't mean this one, this was a good one. Next.
Thank you, Chef. I'll start with your question on the aviation accidents, honorable member. If you notice, most of those private aeroplanes, they are smaller ones, and then they are flying visual. You've got those that are flying instruments, and then those that are flying visual. So most of them that experience these accidents are those that are flying visual. So as a South African Weather Service, we can provide them with the aviation forecast, and then we can say, we recommend that there is no visual flying today in Cape Town or in Grahamstown. So, but then you'll find that some, they tend to say, I've got an experience of the place. I know the mountains around Toyando, so I'll be able to
fly blindfolded.
So most of these investigations, they actually reveal that the forecast itself was recommending that there is no visual flight, so we can only recommend. So the for that one.
What is visual? What's the difference between your visual and your what? instrument. Yes.
Thank you, Chair. For the instrument, for example, we will give the pilot a pressure information. Then that pressure information is used to guide the aeroplane. With the instrument side, so when the aeroplane is landing at the airport, if you lose that pressure, then they know now I'm 10 feet above the ground, 30 feet above the ground, so you can see the display, so then land. And then if that pressure is wrong by 1 millibar, it means you have said you are 30 feet before the ground. Only to find out 30 feet is below the ground, then they can crash. So the accuracy becomes important. And then for visual, the weather has to be clear because the aeroplane must see the mountains, the aeroplane must see the runway, and use his judgment to see that now he is hitting the runway.
I said, when I see a car speed.
Okay. And then for the disaster management, honorable members, you correctly pointed to districts. It's actually districts and municipalities. You know, nationally, the disaster management plan works. So there are still gaps at the districts. Each and every district and the municipality is supposed to have a disaster management plan, which is active in its approach. And the South African Weather Service also is part of that plan, which is led by that particular district or municipality. So what is happening now is that the National Department, COCA, is trying to facilitate that they have, but they don't really have powers to force them. Okay? So that is the challenge. But many of them do have the plans now. Is that now there's still a couple of those plans that are inactive. And in those districts that are active, you can see the results before the severe weather conditions, during the severe weather conditions, and after. Here in the Western Cape, a good example is the Eden district, as an example. So in that district, if the road has to be closed, it gets closed using our warnings. So the inner end, once they understand the potential impact, they close before. You don't get a warning for disruptive snow, and then you only close the road when the other cars are already inside, they'll be trapped, because then the benefit is minimal there. But if you close it before they go to that particular pass, then there's a benefit. But we are working on that because the impact forecasting study that we're doing, the CEO alluded to, who are identifying districts to use them as to pilot the project. So we have identified districts so that will also capacitate and empower them. And then the other one that is related to the Antarctic members, yes, we do participate with the department, more especially via Ocean and Coast, Dr. Maegiso and his team. We plan together for related activities and program. We actually provide a forecast on route and also for that area. It's part of the biggest ocean area we're responsible, which is second best to the U.S., the CEO has said. It's called Met Area 7. And then we also take observations, because there's not much observation at sea. It's quite an important route and also information for the base in Arctic. And also for the flying. So if the aircraft is flying from Cape Town, for example, to the Antarctic, so they need to be aware of the weather condition because there is no alternative runway there. If they cannot land, they need to come back. So it becomes very important. Thank you very much.
Next.
Thank you, Chair.
3 minutes left.
I'll try to be brief. Chair, I'm responding to the question that how do we promote ourselves? I think the main thing is that when we do promote ourselves, it's mainly looking at creating the awareness within the communities and ensuring that they build their resilience.
Now, we do this in a number of ways. I'm sure you've heard some of our staff members talking about weather conditions, for instance, in the media. That is when we talk to the media. It would be broadcast, it would be also print. We also do events. Those events we do in collaboration with the department, but we also partner with other departments. We do commemorative days. For instance, we celebrate things like World Met Day, which is World Meteorological Day, and we do that in various districts. And that celebration, for instance, has grown over the years. From us just in the period between 2000 and 2007, where we just informed the media about the day, to us having fully fledged events where we attract, over 1,000 to over 1,000 people at a time. So those are just some of the ways that we do that. We also go to career days and fairs where we present to maybe school children opportunities and options within meteorology. And that seems to be paying well, because for instance, if you look at the bursaries that we provide, we are providing them to a number of across the board. One, we have meteorologists that can speak the various languages. So whatever radio station is looking for somebody to talk about weather issues, we have meteorologists that can do that in the languages that are spoken in those areas. Secondly, we've got a number of areas where we have a number of students from across the country that take up the bursary program and are then developed into math technicians and so on and so forth. The other area that we do present ourselves is with publications, providing information in publications. For instance, on a quarterly basis, we will put articles in, for example, Sea Rescue, where we can talk about what is happening within that season. When it's fog season, we talk about fog, what the issues are, and how the seamen can help themselves in terms of managing those events. We also talk to disaster management structures through DEMISA. DEMISA, we meet with them on an annual basis, and there we always present, for instance, on innovations in terms of how we can present the weather information to them, how we present the weather information to them, and how they can use that and improve, their lead time. So there's a number of areas where we do talk to communities, the public, and we try and preach, the message of SOLS, that indeed we are a value-added service and not simply just providing the minimum and the maximum temperature. And I must say that as we move along, time is up.
What you can do, if there are questions that you could not answer, you can just send us the answer. In fact, all of them, send us for all the questions just to answer, so that we are able to capture you properly in our report. But again, thanks and thanks a lot for information given. Most appreciated your responses. Most appreciated. If you have to leave, you can leave in peace. Now we will be getting a presentation from Sunbeam. Thank you very much, member of the board, and also colleagues. We most appreciate you. See, this was just an engagement, getting to know you better. Now that we know you better, rest assured when you come for your quarterly performance and your annual performance, you will be, you see, we are more informed, but no, that's not meant to make you feel afraid to come to us, so we're just joking. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Yeah. Chair, I'm going to be very brief. I'm glad you've come to one of your conclusions is the fact that the good work that the Weather Service does very often is not reacted to properly. I look at the Cape Town fire where we knew that the risk was there, we were saying that the risk was there. I'm not saying that nobody responded, but certainly we were a little bit disappointed with the factor of the response result we got. We also know that, for example, in the Eastern Cape, sometimes disaster management doesn't react quickly enough to disaster weather conditions, and in fact we lose lives, etc. So having identified that, I leave here very proud of you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Tanya, there's your hot seat. Now, as you come in very leisurely, you still have an hour. It's 11:35. That means that you will finish your input at 12:35. That's an hour. Again, from where we're sitting, tell us about the important matters that we need to know about yourself. Not anything and everything. Not about your target, but as an institution. What are those things that make you tick? And what are those things that have made you to be a proud asset in the South African government? But again, how being a proud asset, how do you enhance the work of the Department of Environmental Affairs? So again, let's welcome you colleagues and also welcome the chair of the board of the MCT. Most welcome, madam. Of course, the administration led by the CEO, you are most welcome. The platform is yours. We do have your presentation, but of course you can stick to that presentation. If you think 1 hour is not so good time enough for you to finish your presentation. Thank you very much. Platform is yours.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members of the Portfolio Committee. My name is Tanya Albans. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of SANDI. And I'm accompanied here particularly by Mr. Mokesi Kwasi, who is our Chief Corporate Officer, and we're very pleased to have our Chair, our SANDI Board Chair, Mrs. Nana Mahomola, accompanying us. And in addition, both Judy and Skumza are involved in our business from the DEAR level. Skumza sits on our board, as you might know, but also is Head of Biodiversity and Conservation, and so much of our work is engaged with that branch. But over the last 8 years or so, we have increasingly also been involved with the climate change branch. So it's very good that Judy is here as well as Skumza. So just to say, this is the brief background and the key information that I want to go through with you, and I think it's self-explanatory, so let me just go straight into my presentation. And also, Chair, you must excuse me if I am telling you things that you already know. I thought that it might be worth us reminding the Portfolio Committee again what is SANDI's role and vision and mission in South Africa. And so our vision is to provide really to have access of all our people to biodiversity richness. And I think I explained the last time I was here why we particularly wanted to do that, because biodiversity has a history and a legacy of not doing this. And so we wanted to be able to provide this richness to all South Africans. And our mission is to to champion the exploration concept.
Then give us a slide that speaks to that.
The vision.
You have the slide then.
We are still on that.
Okay, so you're going to have to do this. I obviously can't multitask enough.
Yeah.
Sorry, you'll do it. Yeah. I clearly have lost my capacity to multitask as I get older. And so our mission is to champion the exploration, conservation, sustainable use, appreciation and enjoyment of our exceptionally rich biodiversity for all our people. And the goal of the institution itself is to position ourselves to lead that sector in South Africa, and that we are recognized, and as a result, we recognize as the first place you go to for anything you want to know about the knowledge and information and policy advice on biodiversity. And that's our goal, is to position ourselves to be that way. Next slide, please. So, just some key information, which I'm sure you already know, that we are Schedule 3A public entity, so for a public good entity, we report to DEAR. We are responsible to the Minister of Environment, and our board is cabinet appointed, and they are the accounting authority, the delegate authority down to the CEO, but essentially they are eventually the accounting authority of this institution. We are subject to all the usual PFMA and other treasury regulations, including the Auditor General. We are not subject to the public service regulations, but we use most of their prescripts, and that's because traditionally we have our own pension funds. We have staff of approximately 700, sometimes more, sometimes less. Most of our staff, over 50% of our staff, are garden staff, and in this last few years we've expanded our staff members only nominally, because we have brought in 946 altogether young people, young graduates, and young matriculants onto our staffing system as part of a project, which I will tell you a little bit about later. We are based in 11 geographical locations. We run at the minute 10 national botanical gardens, and I'll tell you a little bit about our launch of Kwelecha and the kind of operational stuff we're doing there, and that we will be 11 national botanical gardens hopefully by the end of this financial year, and our head office is in Pretoria, but we also have many staff in Kirstenbosch. So our policy and legal framework has shifted and changed over the last years. Now, I wanted to just say before I leave the issue about some key information, just because SOARs were bragging about the fact that they've been around for 150 years. We've been around essentially for 100 years, starting with the Kirstenbosch Garden, which was land given to the state from Cecil John Rhodes. And the Rhodes bequest is what created the first National Botanical Garden, very ironic. We have a vegetation map that was developed over the decades, which is considered to be a global first, one of the only countries, we now, other countries have joined us, but we were one of the first countries to have a very detailed vegetation map of South Africa, of which many countries have copied. So those are some of the key information about Sandy. Again, just to go back to our policy and legal framework, we are created by the National Biodiversity Act, which really brought together a number of institutions into but mainly the National Botanical Institute into Sandy, and part of the Act, if you read our Act, you will see it includes issues and matters for our responsibility as requested by the Minister of Environmental Affairs. We also play a role in providing science and evidence base for key Department of Environmental concerns, such as the threatened or protected species area. CITES, which you know is about trade in endangered species. We provide the support to DEAR because we run the National Scientific Authority for the country. And of course, CITES, as you know, is having their conference next year on our soil. And so we play a very most important role is to provide the objective science evidence base for DEAR's policy and action. And then in recent times, Chair, after many, many years, the alien and invasive species approach has been approved and now gazetted by the Department of Environmental Affairs. And here, SAMBI plays a key role in providing advice to the state about our invasive species situation. I'll talk a little bit about it later so that you can see that in more depth. But these are really the roles that we play under the regulations that come out of under our Act, which is driven by the Department of Environmental Affairs. Then in addition to that, the government, at the cabinet approved plan is a 20-year vision called the National Biodiversity Strategic Action Plan, the NBSAT, and I'm sorry for all the acronyms here, and we almost need to have a little bit of a book with all the acronyms that we generate in the environment and biodiversity sector. But we have obligations in that strategic action plan, which is the South African Strategic Action Plan. In addition, we also have obligations in the Outcome 10 mandate, which our Minister signed with the President, and now is the medium-term strategic targets, which are to be published or are published already. And then the last thing that why I wanted Judy to stay, because we have in the last year or so beefed up our responsibilities, our legal and mandate responsibilities in terms of climate change. We've always been provided evidence-based science information for climate change to the department for them to make decisions, particularly in the biological side of their data. But in recent years, under the new climate change response paper which has been published, we are given the role of delivering long-term adaptation scenarios for our natural resources. Especially the bio-natural resources, the biological side of the natural resources. And this, of course, requires a lot of research, getting together others to do research, and to provide models for DEAR to make decisions on. So I just wanted to quickly take you through that. Next slide, please. And I think you notice we have a five-year corporate strategic plan, annual performance plan, which is approved by our board and approved by Department of Environmental Affairs. And so it is really the major instrument that we ensure that the work that we do is plugged in into the work that DEAR needs to deliver on. And I must say, Chair, that is managed very well. You should go back, sorry. That is managed very well. In addition, we have a very good governance protocol agreement. And recently, DEAR has investigated that governance protocol agreement with all their public entities to find out whether it's sufficient and whether it works well. And therefore, the governance protocol agreement will be revised and tightened up. And then, of course, we are looking forward to giving progress reports on our quarterly achievements, Chair, because we already do that. And it's analyzed and approved by DEAR. And maybe it would be useful for us to even come to you with a comment that DEAR makes on our quarterly reporting system, just to show you that system, how it works. Next slide, please. So I think you've seen this before, but I think, like SOARs, Chair, we struggle all the time to message our value. And as you know, the public out there mainly are visual. It's easier to do it visually. So we have struggled very hard to depict what we do so that the public and others can see our value. And this is what we call the value. value chain that we've developed, and over time, you might have seen versions of this chair, but over time we think we have improved it. So the foundations of what we do is do the science. Either we do it ourselves or we harness others to do it in teams. But essentially, SAMBI has the quintessential data around our natural biodiversity. And they are in collections in herbaria, they are in museum collections, which are not with us, but we have relationships with. They are the scientists that do the species studies. They are the hundreds and hundreds of inventories that have been developed over the last 100 years. They are the maps of South Africa, the maps of our natural history. They are the understanding of ecosystems and species, and really that is that foundation biodiversity is the engine that generates everything else we can do. Then out of that, we build knowledge about our natural world, and we do assessments. We provide the status of biodiversity report to the minister. We give trends. We monitor and we model, and that's the conversion of raw biodiversity information into something that is about knowledge, and then allows people to make decisions, better decisions. And then from that information, we are then also play a role in advising DEAR on policy, DEAR and other organs of state, and what we call better biodiversity management area of work. And here we do planning, policy advice, we produce tools and models for better biodiversity management. And we think that out of doing all of this, we influence our service delivery and job creation and a better life and a better human well-being in our country, because we are harnessing biodiversity value. We are showing that investing in ecological infrastructure is a good thing. We are showing how climate change is impacting on our biodiversity and ecosystems. And we are also helping to streamline environmental decision-making, which I think, Chair, you will find that sometimes there's a view that understanding environment, understanding biodiversity, puts a break on development. And so we're very keen to streamline environmental decision making so that we cannot be seen to be a obstacle to development. At the same time, what we do and what we have realized is so key to our sector is the human capital development. I'll talk a little bit about that later. And then ironically, I suppose, on the other side of what we do is run this National Botanical Garden system, which are windows for the public and for the citizens to get a taste of our biodiversity. And it's almost like an affordable nature enjoyment space in an urban or peri-urban area. And it contains all our indigenous plants, some of which are threatened, some of which don't even exist in the wild anymore. And so when you go to a garden, you'll get a glimpse of the past sometimes, because there's some plants that you will not see in the wild, but you will see in our botanical gardens. And increasingly, these gardens have become refuges for climate change. So that chair is trying to depict in one picture what we do, and we would really appreciate your comment if you feel that you've been empowered to understand what we do through that picture, but we have wrestled with it over years to very much make the point you made with SOARS. Next one, please. So we organize ourselves into 6 programs, and National Treasury determines that all public entities must start with Program 1, and Program 1 is about corporate services and finance management, etc., etc. So Program 1 is really all our corporate services, including finance, HR, marketing, etc. And what you won't see in this slide, which I wish I had put in, is just a few achievements in the last 10 years, not to make it too much of it, but just to give you a few achievements in Program 1 in the last 10 years. I'll later talk about some of the challenges in Program 1, but let's just talk about the achievements in Program 1 in the last 10 years. First of all, we've always had an unqualified audit for the last 10 years. We in fact won the Clean Audit Award last year from the AG. Secondly, because marketing is included in this Program 1, last year we won, one of our gardens won the best tourism garden in the world in the last year. And I think it's an indication of how we have improved the access of citizens and tourists and travelers to our gardens. Certainly our visitor numbers in all our gardens have increased enormously in the last 10 years. And we've just produced a thing called, we wanted to produce a document that which will give you access to share about a book on our life since democracy. To show some of those changes. The next program is really about our botanical gardens, and I spoke a little bit about that, about what is a botanical garden and how we view it as a place for education, for leisure, for enjoyment, and for spiritual upliftment for very little money, and in urban areas where the majority of our people live. And I think the big achievement here in the last 8 years has been the numbers of gardens we've got. We started at 8, we're now 11, and I think we will come back to you on this when we've done the consultation, but I think that we are wanting to do at least one more in South Africa. We would want our gardens to be geographically spread, number one, but most importantly, we want our gardens to represent every biome of South Africa. And which is why it's very exciting, the Toyando Garden, because it is really Miyombo woodland. Those of you who know that we do not have that depiction in any of our gardens. So we're looking forward to the Toyando Garden, that I'll talk a little bit about later. Then under Program 3, which is to build a foundational biodiversity science, and I talked a little bit about the things we do, maps and collections, etc. But just wanted to say, the journey in this space, Chair, has been to harness the very many institutions that do foundational biodiversity science and to harness them against an agenda which we feel as SANBI, given that we are engaged with our minister and with the MBSAP, we feel we understand that agenda. And so I'll tell you a little bit later about how we have positioned ourselves to lead the agenda for foundational biodiversity science. And we harness the capacities of universities and other institutions for, I think, the South African good, so it's much more focused over the last 3 years. Then the next area, I've also talked about this when I was trying to explain to you that triangle. And this is the area, and Program 4 is where what pops out in the end are major scientific documents, including that around adaptation to climate change, that really shapes very immediately policy. So the progress or the accolade here is in the last 10 years has been the National Biodiversity Assessment, which I hope all of you have got. the 2012 National Biodiversity Assessment, and that was given a special accolade by the OECD. We're one of the few countries that are producing a view of our biodiversity that our minister and our MECs and our MPs can look at and say, I see that the National Biodiversity Assessment is saying that our wetlands are majorly under threat. What are you doing about wetlands? So I'm hoping very much that you'll see, that you'll look at it. It would help us because we've done all the research and now those must read it and take what the research says for policy. Then the other thing that comes out of this area you might be interested in is the Mining and Biodiversity Guidelines. I'm hoping that you've all read the Mining and Biodiversity Guidelines. It's taken a lot of information, scientific research, and we've worked together with the Chamber of Mines and the Department the Department of Minerals and Energy at the time, and we produced last year in 2013 a guideline for mining companies to at least understand what's vulnerable and what's not vulnerable. I mean, that's just one of our projects in there. What's in the future in this area, is also in this area, is the major work we're going to do for the first time in developing an invasive species report, which will require a lot of research, both population research, species research, spread research, using satellite imagery, etc., etc., to produce for the minister the state of invasive species in the country. And as you know, Chair, invasive species probably is the most damaging occurrence, not only for biodiversity, but also for agriculture. And as we've had climate change, and I'm sure if you drive through the Karoo, you'll see already the impact of invasive species on our sheep growing areas, for example. So this is very important work, the invasive species work that we're doing here. Then in Program 5, which is really this area which I often call managing biodiversity better area, where we develop a number of tools, etc. It's in this program, Chair, that we have a major program in support of local government. And we engage with a number of local governments already in assisting them to produce better IDPs that include biodiversity and environment elements. And we've particularly been focusing on rural local governments here, obviously because they often have less resources and often face the problem much more than urban. But we do also work with urban local authorities in this space. So I just wanted to say, under Program 5 is where one of the key things we do is work with local government in support. The other key thing we do in this area, which is something I'm going to talk a little bit later about, is the Biodiversity Information Management System. It is clearly stated in our Act that SAMBI must give access to biodiversity information. And as you know, Chair, it's easy to write it in an act and very difficult to implement it, given that you want to give access to biodiversity information to as many people as possible, including rural people, school children, citizens, professors, university students. So we have really grappled with that. But in the past 10 years, we have moved to be one of the top countries in providing biodiversity information into the global biodiversity information system. But in recent times, we feel that we must do some catch-up in this area, and I'll tell you a little bit about that in my list of things we thought Portfolio Committee would be interested in knowing. And then finally, under the human capital development, which is really around transformation and awareness, we feel we've done major strides in this area. We have had a major program called Groen Sabenza with National Treasury, but at the same time, we constantly have interns, PhD students, and master's students through various means, through the NRF and other institutions, they send them to us and we mentor them, and we feel very proud about the growth of young people in not only science but all the other areas that we work with in Sambi. And in addition, you will see when you ask us for our quarterly reporting that the schools programs that we have of school children coming and being taught by our education officers about environment and biodiversity has been, we've overachieved in that area in terms of numbers. And as you know, Chair, we provide buses for outlying schools, etc., etc. We're really looking forward to Toyando and Kwelecha getting on board so we can capture the schools in the Eastern Cape and in Limpopo as well. In addition, in this area, and this is a very big and important area, it really is the foundation for sustainability of our sector, is this human capital development. We also work with teachers, and we develop textbooks, and we also work with helping young people to make a career choice in a program that we set up called Green Matter. It's one of our programs. So, and I would very much like, Chair, if one day you would come and ask us to make a more in-depth presentation around the challenges to human capital development and education in our sector. Next, thank you. So I think you've also seen before this slide, which is really to depict how we contribute to DEAR's outcomes. And DEAR's outcomes are the LILAC grouping that they have developed through their management system, through their DG, and on to their minister and the deputy minister, and upwards. And the light green box at the bottom shows the areas where we link in with them, and then it goes towards the National Development Plan. Again, I think the honourable member opposite asked again, next slide, how do you tell your story that people can understand? And this was one way also of telling our story. We feel we're part of the whole world around sustainable development. And so our programs contribute to DEAR's outcomes. It's part of the medium-term strategic framework. It links to the National Development Plan, which also links to international agreements that we assist DEAR to be compliant to, and eventually will assist in our contribution as a country to sustainable development goals. And just to say to you, Chair, at management level, we have identified the sustainable development goals that we think our work will assist in, and we'll come back to you and show you that when we've just done a bit more thought. But at least 5 to 8 of sustainable development goals are directly to do with environment, Department of Environment Affairs, and Sandy. And I'm sure Source as well. Next, please. So you asked us in the end, after all of this, you asked us to say what are the strategic matters that requires your attention. And we thought very long and hard about this. And those are the ones that we wanted to bring to your attention as indicators, I suppose, of the kind of work we do as well. So I want the next slide, please, just go to the first one. The next slide, yeah. I'm going to go through them. Okay. So the first bullet point was the issue of overcoming shortage of black scientists and role models in the biodiversity sector. And this is an issue that all of us face in our sector. We have a legacy of an education system that didn't produce black scientists or role models in enough numbers. And if they did, many of them left the country, etc. We feel that we have broken the back of this a little bit. We've appointed 6 new black senior members in the last year or two, and 4 of these are scientists. and four of them are scientists. But what you haven't seen then, which I should have put in, is that our Crohn's Defender program, which I talked about a little bit earlier, is coming to an end. And we have absorbed almost 60 of them, of these Crohn's Defender pioneers, into our fold. And many of them are young scientists. So we are seeing about 35 to 40 young scientists of various kinds having been gained through our Crohn's Defender program on their way to be leaders of our sector. It was an expensive and risky project, but it was worth it because we've actually grown young people to be competent in this very difficult area, I think. The next area we just want to raise to your attention, just to say, Chair, that for us, and I'm sure for you, that accountability is non-negotiable. But we just want to point out that there are a number of increases in compliance that impact on all public entities, and that it in the end does increase the need to spend more money on corporate. And so when you see some of our colleagues, when you see so much activity and resources spent on compliance, you have to understand it. And of course, you like us will re-emphasize the accountability being non-negotiable. But for example, on the occupational health and safety standards, we've done an audit now. As you know, being based in 10 places with gardens and equipment, etc., health and safety, both for our staff and our visitors, are really important. And we've got the structures in place now for health and safety standards. Very important, this area. 2 years ago, the Act was promulgated. Then the next one is the official language policy, and we have investigated this matter. We've done a survey of all our staff and our visitors, and we now have a policy that's approved through our board, and we will proceed to implement it. Of course, Chair, the spirit of the language policy is correct. The more our people in all our 11 languages can have access to knowledge and information around their own natural environment, the better. So the spirit behind that is fine. And it's a good one. The next one is just to say that you would know that there's some new guidelines from National Treasury, including ones on cost containment, and these from the part of Sandby, we've implemented our cost containment measures, and just to give you a heads up. Then there's the two new acts around information, and because we are an information-giving institution, then we feel the strong influence of these acts. One is the COPY Act, and the other one is the PIA, and so we have set in process a mechanism to provide information on these two matters, and we report to the Human Rights Commission on Access to Information Act. I'm sure you know that. Next. I'm not sure. Okay. Next, yeah. So, under Program 2, as you know, Program 2 is about managing our National Botanical Garden system. Wanted to just tell you a little bit about Kwelecha and how far we've got. As you know, it's about 10 k's above Eastern Cape, East London, and it was formally declared by the Minister in July of last year, and we've appointed staff. We are acquiring a small piece of land on the side of it because we do not want to affect the natural area. The natural area is not very big, and the natural area is coastal dunes, very rare coastal dunes that we want to preserve. So we're buying a small piece of already disturbed land on the side, and we have got the necessary agreements from the Buffalo City Metropolitan Municipality just in the last month or so. Next, please. Then our next one, which is not yet gazetted and not yet, the ribbon has not yet been cut, and hopefully, Chair, that when we give you the date, that some of you yourself or your members can come for this. I think it will be quite a momentous occasion. It's the first time we've got a garden so far north. We've been negotiating with the Limpopo province around staff, around transfer of land, around public works, and we've formed a task team to discuss our human resource related issues. We've got resolution on the human resource matters, and that we feel that once we have done the final regulatory and compliance matters, which is the norm, that we would ask the minister to issue an intention to declare, and that we would have a new botanical garden by 2016-17. You know this garden, I'm sure it's the former Venda garden of the Venda homeland. It hasn't had any resources given to it for the last 20 years, not even plastic bags to collect rubbish. But the staff have been paid, and they are great staff because they have really done great with very little resources. Very, very nice people. And that the proposed name at the minute is the Vembe National Botanical Garden. Okay. So Program 3, you remember I went through Program 3 in quite a lot of detail, but the area that I wanted to talk with you about is what we call the FBIP. Sounds like a police state. But it's the Foundational Biodiversity Information Program. And I talked a little bit about how it's taken us a long time to get ourselves in the position for being so influential in the direction of the national ability to generate, mobilize biodiversity information. So in this program, we provide the strategic direction. We do not get the grants from NRF, but we inform and advise NRF where the grants should go, because we're really wanting the kind of research that will affect and will be useful for our developmental goals as directed through the NDP and the Department of Environmental Affairs. So the rationale for this program, and we really think that this program is going to accelerate the questions we've always wanted to ask about biodiversity, especially the species questions. What have we got? What is it? Where does it occur? What does it do? And what is its importance? And it will also allow us to make predictions and trends in species distribution, because we have the old specimens in our collection will also be part of this program. So I wanted you to tell you that this program, this FBIP program, is exceedingly interesting and might also require us to just come and tell you about it in that way. Program 4. I've talked a little bit about Program 4. Let me just go back one page. Yeah, I told you a little bit about Program 4, and there I've just given you some of the products that we've done in the last 10 years, enormous amount of products. And if you go to our biodiversity advisor on our website, you'll see all of that. But I want to do specifically, next slide please, I want to specifically tell you, in the middle of all that information that is there, in this program, I wanted to specifically tell you about the wildlife economy work that we're doing, being led by the Department of Environmental Affairs. And as you know, Chair, we already are, and I mentioned earlier, the runner, we run the scientific authority whose role is to provide advice to the minister on trade in endangered species. So this is completely in our mandate. And we provide the department with the scientific evidence and work that is needed for good decision making in this space, good decision making for licenses and for permits, etc., etc. So that's our role in this space. Next slide, please. So the progress is that, as you know, we already have the National Biodiversity Economic Strategy, and the wildlife economy forms part of this strategy. And our responsibility is to provide science information to Environment Affairs for them to roll out this policy in terms of the biodiversity elements of it. And we have already submitted a proposal to DEER, who will submit to National Treasury going forward the development of the wildlife economy. But meanwhile, Department of Environmental Affairs is running a number of projects already, some 20 projects with our colleagues at Sandparks and others, basically so that we will have case studies for CITES COP. I think there was a view that this project hasn't quite got it started yet, but really when I investigate it with my colleague in Sandby and also with my dear colleague, that this project is very long on the road already, and maybe we should be giving you a specific joint presentation from Sandbox, Sandby and Deer around the progress we've made in the area of the wildlife economy. So in Program 5, you know that this is an area where we provide the information and the support information for decision making, and I just put that up there for you to ask you once again, if you haven't, is to go to the Biodiversity Advisor on our website. It really is all our work and the results of our work and the results of our data collection and scientific endeavor is found in one way or the other through this portal of the Biodiversity Advisor. But I wanted to particularly talk, next page please, I wanted to talk particularly in depth about how we have got to this point of our Biodiversity Advisor and the contents in it and the data in it, and why we need to make a step change in this. So, Chair, we have been a global leader around providing biodiversity data globally, and we have developed innovative tools and systems, and we have very good information policies, and we have good international collaboration, and we are seen to be a benchmark nationally and internationally. But however, you do know, Chair, that this information technology space moves every day. It is quite amazing how fast this moves. And so we have done an analysis of how to be better in this space, because this is a space where you take science and you convert it into information and communication that should be able to be used by the citizens and the decision makers of the country. So we found that our systems, despite our best endeavors, are dated. We still work in silo. We still have duplication of data, that we have very time-intensive processes. We don't have enough interoperability between our systems and our data, and we still lack limited analytical ability within us. This is a very specialized skill. People who are able to take vast data sets and produce the analysis that makes it useful. And we still have a limited ability to monitor use and impact. In other words, monitor the use of our information and the impact that we're having on the country with our information. Next slide, please. And so just to give you an idea of what we've done so far, those are some of the things we've done so far in Biodiversity Day, that we have 35 biodiversity plans, 400 individual map layers, 14 million species records, 50,000 observations. We have red list species of over 20,000. We have information and pictures of over 10,000 plant species. We're busy just doing the animal species just now. We've got the species status of South African species. So a lot of information in there, but we're still not satisfied that we are ahead of our game on this. Next slide, please. And so we're moving toward this integrated information architecture. We were very lucky to have got capital expenditure, capital money from the National Treasury, and so we're going to invest in the infrastructure here. We want to be ahead of Mexico, Colombia, and Brazil on this area. 5 years ago, we were advising Brazil on how to get in this area, and they've left ahead of us, and we want to catch up with them. They are the second highest biodiversity. We are the third highest biodiversity, and Indonesia doesn't seem to be playing in so much in the game. Next slide, please. So I wanted to just tell you a little bit about that. Then, also in this area of Program 5 is the work that we do with climate change, and that's why I'm glad Judy's here. So just to remind you, Chair, I think we told you last term that the Minister asked SANBI to become accredited as a national implementing entity, as that's what I call it, an NIE, firstly, the Global Adaptation Fund. And we did, we were successful. It was very difficult to become accredited, by the way, Chair. They went through our books, our audits, our systems, our labor systems, our environmental systems, our values, our whole governance protocols for us to get that national implementing entity status. And we developed two major projects. One project we've told you about, the project in major project in KwaZulu-Natal in the Umgeni River Basin. And that project is worth about 7.5 million. It's given us an opportunity to work with the local authority, the Ngungundlovu municipality, and we're working together basically to develop a whole lot of resilience capacity with the communities in that area. And then the second big project we developed was a local adaptation small grants facility, which is approximately about 2.5 million, and it's divided between two major areas, the Mopani area and the Namakwa area, and essentially it's small grants for communities to do their resilience themselves. And here, SANBI has been a world leader in developing the system for this. And so I think this is why the minister, when she came back from Lima, having been part of negotiating this new funding mechanism called the Green Climate Fund, which is why she then asked SANBI to apply for accreditation to the Green Climate Fund. And that's what we're in the process of doing now. We're very hopeful that we will get that. But the Adaptation Fund is a much smaller fund, and the Green Climate Fund is a very much of a bigger fund. And I'm hoping that you will ask us to come and particularly give you a presentation on what our expectations are around the Green Climate Fund. And finally, Program 6, and we talked, I talked a little bit about Flinta Benda and the work that we're doing with Green Matter, our program to grow careers, to grow teachers, to work with textbooks, to work with higher education institutions. And in this whole area of human capital development, I want you to really focus on the Khunsa Bezina program to basically tell you what's happening in that space. Next slide, please. So our progress in this, to date, we have out of 800 pioneers. Let me just say that our National Treasury commitment was 800 pioneers, or DBS pledge commitment of 800 young pioneers, 500 graduates and 300 matriculants, that they will come into our sector, hosted by 44 institutions in our sector, to grow them and to make them work ready for permanent jobs. So today, and we are 3 months, 2 months, 3 months towards the end of this project. So to date, 254 of these pioneers have found permanent jobs, either within us, of the 44, or out in the world. Out of that, 227 have been offered employment contracts, over and above that, by the end of the project. And I just got a call from the LEDET head of department saying that he's committing to 109 pioneers to come into the debt. So that figure must be, is about 330, 340 will have been offered permanent employment by host institutions. And so the total jobs created is 481 plus 109. It's over, it's almost hitting 600. And we are really struggling to finalize this project. And we would wish that every one of these 800 pioneers would get a job, either in our sector or even out of our sector. The National Treasury have put us under an intention to withdraw status, and they want 600 jobs by the end of July, the beginning of August. And as you can see, we are like 3 jobs short of the 600 jobs to lift that ITW. So it's caused us huge stress, but I must say, and we've got plans to bring in others to get the numbers up. But I must say, Chair, that I'm sure you feel that way as well. You saw one of these Klosterbenzer young women when you came to visit us, that no matter how much we are going to be beaten up here, that the end result of changing these 800 young people's lives, I think, is priceless. Next slide, please. And with that, I'd like to also thank you, colleagues, honourable members, for having visited us in Kirstenbosch, and I hope that our presentation and your visit to our collections and to the Boomslang was memorable when you came. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. We now have a better view and a better understanding of what you're doing. Maybe before we even ask any questions, the same formula, any word from yourself?
Thank you very much, Chair, indeed. Thanks to the members, honorable members of the portfolio committee. Maybe I just want to just say a few things about us as members of the board and how we see our role. And again, to thank you for creating this opportunity for us. For the governance side of things, Chair, what I'd like to share with you is that I feel privileged to lead the team of board members that we have. In my view, well-selected, highly skilled people coming from different professions, and in particular having, as members of our board, scientists, people who understand finance, but also in particular, they are highly experienced in terms of how the board operates. I know as portfolio committee members, you do get concerned about the, you know, challenges that are faced by board. We have, I believe, a good relationship the way we operate as board members, but also in particular having a good understanding of the relationship and a delineation of the roles between board members and staff. Again, privileged to have the kinds of the CEO and the executives who are also highly skilled, knowledgeable, and you don't find ourselves having to run around and figure out whether the work is done and done in the correct way. I spoke about the clear understanding of our roles and responsibilities. We do have robust debates, because once when I said that we have a good working relationship, I was misunderstood to mean that we do not ask questions. We do ask questions, but luckily for us, we do get the responses that we are expected. So there's a good understanding of our fiduciary responsibility, good understanding of the oversight role that we have as a board, but also understanding that we do not need to micromanage people who are experienced and they know what they're doing. But also, almost lastly, to say that we also appreciate the political oversight that we have, the engagement that we have with the minister and the team from DIA, led by the DG, constantly engaging with them, getting the support that we need, getting the assistance and the guidance. And now, very appreciative of the portfolio committee also engaging with us, and we look forward to more engagement, more guidance. And you did say that you'll interrogate the work that we do. That is appreciated, because if we do not speak, we will not be able to, you know, to carry our mandate in the way that is expected. So just in a nutshell, Chair, to thank you for the opportunity, and to say we look forward to more engagement. There will be robust, you told us, but then that will help us to make sure that we deliver for the country, because we're not here for ourselves, we're here to make sure that we deliver for the country. And I thank you for the opportunity.
Good. Now, of course, as you will know, some members have got to catch flights, and when they get to Joburg, they catch other flights to their destination. So that's why we have lost two members now. But be that as it may, we are still here. Honorable Mabila.
No, Honorable Chair, I don't feel intimidated. I'm alone. I'll represent the committee well. Thanks, Chair. I think we first have to welcome the presentation. It's quite comprehensive, detailed, and it gives us a sense of what SAMBI is all about. I was just inquisitive when the CEO and the doctor of SAWS were comparing notes around their existence. One is 155, and the other one, to be exact, is 104. 9 March 1902 was SAMBI established. So SAMBI has quite a long history. But obviously, now that somebody is 104 years old, we need to reflect that the development is still following the old spatial pattern of apartheid. In terms of your gardens, your botanical gardens, I can argue to say there's no botanical garden in the townships. So I would like to get a response of somebody around the question of, is in their plan a move to establish botanical gardens in townships where the majority of our people are found. Because most of the best in botanical gardens are in town, and they are inaccessible to many other people. And many other people would not know about botanical gardens, and seldom would they visit them. So that's the first question. Are there moves to ensure that we establish botanical gardens in the townships? Your core mandate is, amongst others, is the protection of biodiversity and the ecosystem. Now, my question would be to say, around your invasive species program, which takes place mostly in affected areas, for civil society. Problem, because adversely invasive species will pose a serious problem to human livelihood, as you have presented in the last time, the hunger what it is called in different names and many others. I just want to know, are there, I mean, is civil society playing a role in that? Are youth playing a role in that? Are youth playing a role in that? Now, I've just read the business day of June. I just learned that there was a biodiversity planning forum, and it is not in your presentation. Can you maybe just tell us something more about it so that we get more information about it? Lastly, it will be around the capacity of SAMBI to play a role in the protection of biodiversity vis-a-vis your SIPs, your strategic integrated projects, where there are major developments. Will some be in having the capacity to ensure that biodiversity is not destroyed vis-a-vis the development? Yeah, I think that is it. And then lastly, it will be your national vegetation map. What is the current development around it? Thanks. I think those will be the few questions. Thanks.
Thanks. We cannot talk about biodiversity and not be concerned about protection of our ecosystems. Now, the same question will arise. It's good that Judy is here. She has not answered it. I don't expect you to answer it. Have we looked at the impact of pollution and pollutants on our ecosystem? That's something. Indeed, we don't expect you to go. We have not reported on that here in your presentation. Safe to say that you have reported on how you have the data that goes a long way, and how that data has also been converted into a web system that can be accessed. Of course, there are also reports on that data from time to time on the state of our biodiversity. The various aspects of our biodiversity sector. But my interest here is, again, it arises out of what we have been through in recent times, our visits to various municipalities, getting reports and presentations from the polluting industries, and the very disturbing non-capacity that we collided upon at the level of municipalities. With all these things put together, have we done our deep seek? Now, as SAMBI, together with the department, to see what is the impact of all these pollutants on our environment, on our ecosystems, and on all these things that you are responsible for, the various species that you are responsible for, even in your own, even in your own botanical garden, just the health of these inhabitants of your botanical garden. That would be one. The other one is, You have, in your presentation, you have also added quite some things that are not on the presentation. If you can just give us those. You are right that on wildlife economy, it might sound a little bit confusing, I know. in some other times our colleagues ask questions. And those questions basically say that we are moving at a speed, at a tortoise speed in this area of work. Maybe you are right that why don't we say let's have a presentation by all of you so that we get where are we, whether yourself, Sanbi, with Santa, we can even include Isimangaliso and also the department. Particularly that the people that assist with the wildlife economy. So that we have a sense of where are we? We work fine, you can't be assisting with science, evidence, whatever, we hear that. But all we know is that we do have wildlife. You see, that doesn't need science. We know that we do have wildlife. We know that the people that have been advantaged all along are benefiting from the wildlife that we have. Some went all the way from America to kill a harmless lion in Zimbabwe the other day. So, indeed, we also know how much these profits are worth to the owners of these safaris and whatever. And none of these owners, I can tell you, I've visited many of these owners of wildlife, what do you call them, sanctuaries or whatever you call them, safaris. None of them are of the color of my skin. None. It's still a very untransformed economy that is resident with white male. Unfortunately, we are the majority in this country, those of us who are a little bit blackish. It's very unfortunate that we don't have any ownership in this economy. We don't have. And in fact, one colleague of mine even said he went to some countries that don't even have these big fires. But people in those countries trade in these big fires that they don't have. They trade, and it would be nice just to have your take. It can't be right that we took so many years to recognize that there is something called ocean economy. I don't know where the hell we're sleeping when others were beneficiating from this economy called ocean economy. Till now we are still at starting steps, at starting blocks. Even on this one, where we have had the Bubezis for so long, we have had all these things, this Impala for so long, and the elephants for so long, and we never even thought how. And in fact, we have had people who have been benefiting, by the way, on this economy for so long. Your rhinos, in fact, some we even give them these rhinos. We give to them these rhinos. Of course, others, they buy them. We give other countries these rhinos. We don't know how they benefit economically from this assets that we give to them. But be that as it may, just as you go back, tell whoever you're going to tell that we think that you're not doing what you're supposed to do. Not only you. You working with whoever who's in the economic sector. Those that are supposed to ensure that our GDP is improved. When you don't do justice to some sectors of the economy, including wildlife, how on earth are you going to improve the GDP of our country so that indeed we are able to give employment to the millions? At the moment, if we look at only 25% of unemployed, we are talking about 12.5 million people. Just at 25%. And I'm told that unemployment is over 25%. Now we are sitting on this gold called wildlife. Now, we are speaking politics here. We are not, and indeed we are politicians, you understand that. Therefore, it would have been good for us to get a report of what is the input of the wildlife economy to our GDP now as we speak. To the, and I can tell you, I'm not very much sure, even if there is an input, 5% or 2%, that input is also white. So we would really appreciate your assistance. And you say under section program 5, you support local government, just say how. As you report, as you say to us, how do you support local government within that program? But having said all that, what that we have said, you know, you said Indonesia is not playing much in this space, but they are number one. Number two is Brazil, number three is ourselves. So please, let's not lie to ourselves. So we still have a lot to do, we agree with you. We have a lot to do because, you see, that they are number one in the area of being the most diverse in terms of biodiversity. It doesn't come as a fluke. Unless they are part of FIFA, but they are not. some reputable organization has come to the conclusion that they are number one. And let's do whatever that we have got to do so that we either continue at number three or go up the ladder and not go down. We agree with you that we need to do more. Your green Selenza, it's green. Okay, in English it's green. Green. English. Your green Selenza, a wonderful project. And if indeed such project has proven that it can not only give people very scarce skills, and ensure that they are employable, those that have not been employable for years. Can we take this matter ourselves, write to us a letter, showing how this program has improved lives of our people over years, so that from our side we see, how do we make an intervention? I didn't understand what you mean by 600, whatever. But you are saying, all I know that you are saying that in the next 2-3 months, this program, or the funding of this program by Treasury, is coming to an end. That's what I heard. Now, when we have a country that has got unemployment levels that are so scary, and we have got programs that can show that we can improve the lives of our people, and we can bring scientific evidence of having improved lives of our people and kept them in employment and having given them the necessary skills for them to be kept in employment. I don't think that, you know, there's somebody who's a friend of mine, his name is called Ntantlamene. I don't believe that if we bring evidence just on the program, that anybody, including another friend of mine who's the president of this country called Gedleyihle Zuma, if we say, tell us on what political grounds would you say you can't fund this? On what grounds? Political, economic, or social, or otherwise? Now, maybe you can enlighten us. Of course, every program, whatever funding that the Treasury will give, has some timelines. We have no problem with that. But I know that Treasury can review funding of any project to continue or not to continue. From where we are seated with the information we have now, will be to approach Treasury from a basis that says, please continue. And here's evidence. And if you can't, Can you please tell us why? Because we will go to Parliament. We can debate that matter in Parliament as well. That here is work that has been done and in the interest of our people, and here are many young people who have been able to be absorbed through this program. Like many other programs, I know that there are other programs that are going on. By the way, there's a program in my township called EPWP. People are employed, not given any tools to work. Most of the time, they are just roaming around and get paid at the end of the month. Of course, not much. I don't know. I don't know how much. But get paid. That program is ongoing. Now, I don't know who reviewed that one. But this one, we can see the impact it has made in the life and dignity of these young people. I would then say, give us more information. Based on that information, we can then approach whoever that we have got to approach, including the ministry and the treasury. Thank you. You can then respond to the other issues.
Thank you, Chair. I'll try and respond to most of it. I think one of the questions I'm going to ask my colleague, Mr. Quackley, to respond to is the issue around health and safety, which I think came up, and some of the challenges we got there, and to ask Skumza to maybe respond on the wildlife economy, and for Judy to respond a little bit on some of the issues around bush encroachment and invasive species. So let me just start with question number one, which is on the botanical garden. So the National Botanical Garden System is, in theory, not a lot of gardens. In theory, the National Botanical Garden should be a window into the biome, that biome. And as I said, we have not had a representative of that biome in the north until now. We're getting Tuendo. So that's the notion of a National Botanical Garden. But we have skills and capacity and abilities that we should be sharing with our other colleagues at province and local government level about how to run botanical gardens for the leisure and pleasure and education of local people. And so just to say that we have got some relationships with some botanical gardens. In other words, with us as the National Botanical Garden System, we have a relationship with them. We are also thinking that maybe we do not need to run all National Botanical Gardens, because it is a legal construct, but that we could confer a standard to others so that they could also...
Tanya, so that you don't... are there any gardens, whether provincial, local, at any rural area or township? Very simple.
No National Botanical Gardens, but there are many municipal ones and some provincial ones. That's the answer.
Are we planning? You said there was a reason why you asked.
No, I can understand, yeah.
Is there any thinking of creating a national botanic? Because I can tell you, I know the Mufulo Garden in Soweto, by the way. By any comparison, it doesn't compare to the National Garden in Johannesburg. Or is it in Johannesburg or Pretoria? All that we are saying, so that we don't go all over the place, a botanical garden that is of the same nature and quality in a rural area. I think there should be biomes in those rural areas. Of course, the better one would be in a rural area, for instance. But we are saying, just from a political consciousness, where, of course, that one was in the homeland, of course, you see, again, continuation of your apartheid design. All we are saying, think about it, that how you work together with the provinces and locals to construct one. That we can say, you see, this one came because of our democracy, not because of some homeland, and not because, we were these were leftovers from apartheid. Mm-hmm. no matter the good work that they do and the improvement that we have done, the transformation, they their locations are still at Kirstenbosch. Thank you. I've answered for you.
So, Chair, we do have more than just one garden in the rural area. We've got one in Hantam, and we talked a little bit about it before, I think. Hantam is in the southern part of Northern Cape. It represents really the biomes of that region. One of the reasons why we chose the Kwelecha Garden, apart from the fact that it was particularly focusing on the coastal biome and coastal species, was that it's near that large areas that of East London, Tansani area. That
where is it?
It is 10 kilometers north of East London, Kwelecha.
Okay.
You must come and visit it. It's very beautiful. Anyway, the other, and of course the Vembe Garden. But I don't want to go back and forth on this, and I think we'll show you the guidelines for an MBG, which is part of the issue. But what I want to say is, and I want to agree with you, Chair, is what is Sandy's role in supporting municipalities to provide green spaces and gardens? And that's a very good question. I want to just take it down, and we'll come back to you with a plan. Because I do agree with you that we have got this expertise in our garden, we should be giving it to others. We do have relationships with some, Grahamstown Botanical Garden, Durban Botanical Garden, but I think your point is taken. What is our relationship with the Soweto Botanical Garden, for example? So we'll come back to you on that. We do have a number of programs to include civil society and citizens in biodiversity. We've got a program called Custodians of Rare and Endangered Wildlife. They are the ones, and we have a big program on that, and there's more information. I'm worried about time. We also have an eye engagement, which you might be very interested in. Anybody with a phone that is able to take a photograph can get onto iSpot. And if you see anything, a plant, an animal, an insect, anything in the biodiversity world, and you're interested about what it is, you can take a photograph, upload it, and ask the question. And that's the way we've got citizens to help us, but also to excite citizens in biodiversity. And then, at least I want to say those two major projects. And of course, there were other elements. I hope that answers your question. I think it was a very good question. I hope I'm answering it in its fullest need. You were saying, you started out saying, the protection of biodiversity and ecosystems. How are you harnessing the citizens to be part of that protection and ecosystem? That was the question you asked. One of the interesting things also, Chair, is that our bird data is actually generated by citizens. It's one of the big citizen sciences data that's driven by citizen science is our bird data. And as you know, the bird data of South Africa is very, very old, and much of it is driven by citizens. The next question you asked, Honourable Minister, was on the Biodiversity Planning Forum.
Not yet. Been a member of parliament.
What did I call it? Did I call it? Did you say not yet? I'm sorry.
He qualifies as a member of parliament. Then he might be appointed, but not yet appointed.
My apologies. My apologies, honourable member. The planning forum is a very interesting one, and I think that when you next have your oversight meeting with us, it might be good to time it with the planning forum. The planning forum has run for some 10 years, and this is where, you also asked me later, well, how do we support local government, for example. This is where all the planners that are anything to do with land, biodiversity, the natural environment, water, rivers, wetlands, mountains, everything in our country. coming from all the municipalities of our country and all the provinces and institutions in this space. And we gather once a year basically to talk about the advances we've made. In the first 5 years, the debate was even just what is the unit standard for the map that you see we keep on displaying. That map and the unit standard for that map and the blocks which make up the data was negotiated at that biodiversity planning forum. And so what's the result? If you go to Namakwa or you go to Chris Hani municipality, just for example, the young planner in that municipality will have our maps. They use our maps. They come to our planning forum. So that's been a major driving force to get coherency around our data and information. And so every year, new things come up, whether it's the challenges around dealing with local government and what are the best ways to assist local government to get biodiversity inserted into their integrated development plans, or whether it's the challenges around the SIPs, for example. So I've attended that meeting every year since I've been the CEO, so the last 9 years. And it just grows and grows. Many young people, many of our Khunsa Benza pioneers have been every year that they've been with us, and they've learned enormously. So what's the result? Out of that Khunsa Benza pioneer group, quite a few of them are excited about planning. Because planning, it's something that's both the content and the science as well as the IT. They like it, that combination. So we've really developed, and I think you met one of them when you came for your oversight visit, who made the presentation on the mapping and the GIS, and he's a Khunsa Benza, which we're absorbing full of flow. So yes, the Biodiversity Planning Forum has been really growing and the driving force for change and understanding and building capacity at all levels of government around spatial planning tools, better understanding of biodiversity and vegetation, where our biodiversity lies, etc., etc. So that's been a good one. So the role of SANBI and the SIPs was the next question. I hope that was answered okay. The role of SANBI and the SIPs, as you might know, Chair, I'm calling Minister, as you will know, Chair, the department, the DG of the department, requested that CSIR, the Council of Geosciences, and ourselves, that we form a troika to provide advice to her for good decision making on the SIPs, because it is the Department of Environment Affairs which ultimately provides the environmental authorization for all the SIPs. And so the departments themselves have developed what they call a strategic environmental assessment framework. And we are, along with Council of Geosciences and CSIR, providing the science and evidence base in that framework for the minister to make the decision. So we do not make the decision. We provide the evidence in a way that ministers and the department can understand. And then out of that, they must make the decision. But this is the strategic environment assessment is a very interesting instrument because it looks at the economics and the social aspects and the people aspects, and they look at 360 degrees. And we are to provide the evidence in those boxes. But in the end, the department will advise the minister about the decisions to be made. But you raised the question, I think an important question, about the role of CSIR, SANBI, and the Geoscience Council in getting the SIPs be sustainable, but also reducing the barriers to business in the SIPs with good information. So that's a very interesting
5 minutes thing. Left.
So the impact of pollution and pollutants on biodiversity, just to direct you to two big areas, and I think you're going to talk about the other one. this Ngeni, well, we've actually done quite a lot of work in the past on a national level, looking at the state of wetlands, the state of the freshwater system. And the latest one, I think 2 years ago, was the national freshwater status, where we looked at, with our colleagues, all the rivers, tributaries and main rivers, and looked at their states. And their states is to do with degradation. Sometimes people are just, well, the soil has just silted up rivers, or it's to do with pollution, chemical pollution, human pollution, waste, all those sort of things. And we've made a book which basically gives you a sense of the state of our rivers in 2013. And we make very interesting reading, that particular one. In addition to that, we've been working closely with the department around the land degradation. And we've got a major project now on land degradation. We've got a lot of data on land degradation, where soil erosion, etc., has occurred, which actually is a real problem. So we've got lots of data and information. One of the exciting things about the Ungeni River project that we're doing in that whole Ungeni River, right from the foothills of the Drakensberg right down to Itikwini municipality, is the issue of having a focused district, and I know you like that word, Chair, a focused district in an area which has high population. I don't know if you've been in that area. It's a high populated area. Huge amount of pressure on the land, quite a lot of soil runoff, potentially quite a lot of rivers which also have alien invasives in it, and to really work as a dipstick in an area to see what are the components that we need to put in place, not only just to cry wolf, because we're good at crying wolf, this is bad, but to say what do you need to overcome it. So that Ungeni River project, the whole project, basin project that we're doing, ranges from looking at better places for housing, better improved materials for housing, cleaning up of river banks and wetlands, as well as talking to the farmers high up in the foothills of the Drakensberg to improve their farming practices, because actually the soil runoff starts up there and it exacerbates all the way down that thing. So this is an exciting project, and when I retire, I would like to be a researcher on that project, because it's extremely exciting indeed. And so therefore, one of the ways of local government, apart from the work that we're doing with municipalities such as Chris Honey, etc., this is an example of focusing on a municipality that has got quite unique problems, high density of people, large impact on their ecosystems. And thank you for the Frunzebender comments. I will take that on board. Definitely we'll get back to you on that. I hope that answers all the questions. And then just to ask Frunze to talk about the wildlife economy, and Judy to talk about pollutants and impact. And then Mukhetsi, I think you also asked a question about our own environment as an institution. Our own environment activities to improve our own compliance as an institution. So I'm going to go to that. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. If I may start, just to also reflect on the comments that you've made around the future expansion of the gardens. The first thing that we identified as the new board, I sit on the research and development committee of the board, was the fact that there is a lack of a bigger vision, a future vision for the development of the botanical garden. And what we have requested shall be to undertake is to develop such a strategy, an expansion strategy for the garden. I think perhaps what we could then take back is your recommendation around the institution needing to also be cognizant of the transformation imperative and needing to also then
venture out into developing some of these gardens in rural areas as well as township. I think as far as the issue relating to biodiversity economy are concerned, Chair, what we have done as a department, you will recall that our focus has mainly been around conservation of biodiversity. However, we also realize that for the three-legged pot to be able to stand, we also need to also focus on the social as well as the economic aspects of sustainable development in the biodiversity and conservation space. We have really worked well in terms of the conservation aspect as well as in terms of the social aspect. However, in relation to the economic aspect, we have really been found wanting. So what we have been doing in the past year or so is to undertake a situational analysis because we did not even understand where we are in respect of economic issues in relation to biodiversity conservation. So we have undertaken such a situational analysis and we kind of understand exactly where we are, and we have also defined where we go, which is what the vision which was presented in Mthatha when we had the People and Parks conference. However, going back home after that conference, we also realized that we also needed to clearly define the market segments, and we have done that very well. We now know that we have three main sectors that we are looking at. We are looking at issues around bioprospecting. We are also looking at wildlife economy. We are also looking at ecotourism development. So that those are the three main sectors that underpin this biodiversity economy. So what we have been doing in the past few months is to elaborate a very comprehensive biodiversity economy strategy. We have been consulting with other relevant government departments. We've consulted with the
department. Why don't we make things easier? Can we say make a presentation to us on that aspect in a date that we will determine? Because it is quite an important area, so that we don't harass you with many questions. So it would be good if you come prepared with a presentation. What would be your view on that?
Yes, no, Chair, we will certainly do that. We will certainly do that. We've just been consulting stakeholders now. I think now that that consultation process is almost over, we are ready to engage the committee. We will definitely bring all our public entities, SAN, the Sand Parks, as well as Eastern Analysis.
That's better there. Oh, Chief something.
Thanks, Chair. Just briefly on the occupational health and safety throughout our gardens. Our approach was to recently do a nationwide audit to establish the gaps, and we've taken the recommendation that came from that. And we've looked at the, we've put structures in place at all management echelons, from senior management down to the garden level, as required by the Act also. And then we've also started on training on various aspects, like the identification of hazardous chemicals, how to handle chemicals, for instance, also how to do fire drills in the various aspects of our gardens. And we've also embarked on establishing standards that are required by the Act, particularly in the area where we have service providers coming into our gardens, for instance, for the electricians who come and do work, even on construction, because we realized there was a sort of legacy in that that area. So we are enforcing that they also abide by our safety standards. So that one is also ongoing. And I also mentioned that the fire assessment and the fire drills, we're revisiting that. We've embarked on a national lightning an exercise when that led to the retrofitting of our electrical conductors to make sure that our employees and visitors are safe. And that we did with the assistance of South Incense, of them showing us where the high lightning strikes are in various areas national. So it was a very good collaboration together with our sister organization. And Chair, also also when it comes to the physical protection of our assets, I mentioned yesterday that, you know, the cycles, the theft on that area is quite another thing. So we are investigating even putting chips, microchips, in some of our cycles. And someone would say, you know, animals have been a major focus, but we've realized that cycles is actually a very serious area. So it will then take technology as well, just to make sure that our plants are protected. And then the eradication of invasives, I think the CEO has spoken quite extensively on that, because it's another area. Invasives have a potential of actually overcoming our indigenous plants, killing them off, and so that they take over. So we have this program that actually looks at how we deal with invasive species. And that is, we are rolling it over nationally as well. And also when it comes to conservation of our indigenous plants, we have programs where we go out into the wild to identify plants that are endangered. We bring them back into our nurseries. We propagate them and make sure that we grow them up back again, and then we then take them back into the wild. So it's a program that looks at going into the wild, bringing them into nurseries, and taking them back into the wild so that they are planted and conserved there. So, Chair, I think in a nutshell, that's what we want to say about occupational health and safety. I'm just talking broadly, but even within offices and making sure that our staff are always safe, there are many other problems related to occupational health and safety. Thanks.
You need 2 seconds.
Thank you, Chair. Just 2 points on the alien invasives and the link with climate change. Chair, you're very familiar with the Working for Water program that is being driven around removing alien invasives and job creation, etc. But I think what the critical thing here is the invasives are driven by a changing climate. Invasive species are they're pioneer species, they're fast-growing species, and they take over from the indigenous biodiversity. And an additional component of that is that increasing concentration of CO2, drives growth of certain tree species, certain woody tree species, in particular invasives, and that affects our grasslands and our palatable grasslands, and therefore grazing lands, for example. And there are phenomenal photographs that are available of the same point, a photograph taken of the same point with a 20-year period in between, where you can see a radical change and loss of grazing area. And that's an important area of mapping and work that is being done by SANBI, and work that is needing to be built into the adaptation, climate change response adaptation program.
Colleagues, I know that we would have liked to ask some more questions, but we will still meet through quarterly interactions and other interactions that are in our ways of doing things. But again, thank you. I know some of us must run and catch the planes now that SOS has made safe. So, but again, then thank you. Just one thing that we just need to say as a parting shot. to you, Judy. We attend to Mgeni River. We attend to our species that are threatened by invasive species. Good. We don't see what is the impact of these things and pollutants on our people. We have no program that all of us can be proud of, that, you know, we dipstick on a regular basis on what are the effects of all these things on our people. Indeed, we have no problem with us looking at our ecosystems. Even if us, we have raised the issue of ecosystems. And so we appreciate that there is some element of work that is being done in that area. Up to now, we have not received something conclusive that says, this is what we are doing to safeguard the lives of our people from pollutants and polluters. That is our parting shot. And rest assured, we will call you now to just come on that issue. Just on that item, what do we do for all of us to deal with all these respiratory difficulties that some of our people have that arise from pollutants? But secondly, before we can do anything, we need to know what is the status of those communities that are victims of polluting companies and polluting cars, for that matter. We are not getting any joy in that area of it. But even go to an extent of saying, what are the financial costs to the pairs, public pairs? Because these people, most of them are poorest of the poor. They will not go to, they don't even have these things that are called, what do you call them? Medical aid. They rely on your public institutions. So we are then subsidizing these polluters. Subsidizing these polluters as through my tax for our people to get medical care in our clinics and in our hospitals. I think we can do things better. We can do things better, and we cannot continue talking. We know that we have been talking about this. Maybe it's good that we have brought it to your attention, and it's unfortunate that even our municipalities don't even see the correlation between our people's health and the need to enforce our air quality standards. But the other point that we have made, and while we have not signed science to back our assertion, is that even if all industries were to adhere to our standards, pollution by its very nature has an effect on our people. It is our view. Now, we have not seen science to back this view up. But it's for our government to say, even in areas where we have been constant, we have not gone beyond the... Because again, even all these companies, we are from Sasol. You are not there. Well, they were saying their PM10 and PM24 was at the region of over 600 scales. And we brought them down to around 200 scales. What happened to our people when their levels of pollution were undetermined or were unregulated by apartheid and colonial rulers? Now, we are saying, having learned from asbestos, let's not be caught with our whatever when it comes to these pollutants. Because when our people, they will not blame apartheid, they will blame us, by the way. They will blame us because we are in government, we are in authority, and we are the people also that inserted in our constitution that they must be protected from the harmful effects of the environment. Now, we will keep on saying these things, Judy, that as you protect the ecosystems, as you protect our biodiversity. Does that biodiversity include humans? I don't know. Hopefully it doesn't. But the day when it does, let's come and prove that we are able to protect our human beings too. That controls our discourse, and I know that, and again, thank you very much, colleagues, for the information that you have given us. We hope that you will send us whatever other information that we will still need. We will interact with you on the wildlife economy or biodiversity economy, because it's not only wildlife, there are other aspects of the biodiversity economy, including our farmer, what do you call it? Not farmer to farmer. These things that people make medicines from, pharmaceuticals. So that we all know, these people that have stolen our head to make medicines, I know we have put a stop to that. But again, we only woke up 5 years ago. So we're sleeping on the job. Woke up 5 years ago to put a stop to this. And now we can't even touch them. They say that, no. We didn't take these things from you. They've even changed the names of these herbs that they stole from us, and they came up with all these medicines in France, in Germany, and everywhere else. But again, as you come, if we can also have a sense, because it also falls within that ambit of biodiversity economy. How have we beneficiated that area of red pharmaceuticals? As we went to Kirstenbosch, we saw how much we are endowed with wonderful herbs that can cure all sorts of things when subjected to wonderful scientific systems. Having said that, thank you very much. We know that we are loading you with so many things. Loading, you know, that's the problem of coming to a portfolio committee. Even if we are two, we can engage you until tomorrow. Until tomorrow morning. But thank you very much. I know that there is food that is available here. Mama, chair of the board, thank you very much. CEO, thank you very much, and the colleagues, and the DGG, and the acting DGG, acting COO. Are you acting COO? Okay. And also all other colleagues from the Office of the Director General, Office of the Minister, and Deputy Minister, most welcome. We know where they are, by the way. We know where the Minister is. I hope she's elected again in the Women's League. I know where the Deputy Minister is. So, thank you very much. Let's go and eat. See you when you see us. Don't call us, we'll call you.